WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Julene.
Thank you very much, and welcome. Julene, not with me tonight. I remember a couple of weeks ago, she was off because her dog was having physical problems. This is a 5-year-old wonderful boxer named Etta James, after the great R&B singer. 5-year-old boxer and having some real difficulties. And she said she didn't know what to do. And I said, why don't you know what to do? You'd have to stay home with that dog. Because everyone who has a dog loves their dog. But when you don't have children, like my wife and I don't, and Jolene doesn't, those little critters, they mean a lot more to you. So let's send our best. I thought, I'm getting worried. I thought Jolene was going to post on our Facebook page what was going on. And also I called her and nothing from her. I'm not thinking the worst. So let's just keep her in our thoughts. If you do things, do religious people pray for dogs? If you do that. Okay. Anyway, welcome. This is our regular phone-in talk show on WRIF, this time set aside by this great, legendary rock and roll station to give me, and particularly you, the listener, a chance to voice your opinions on the subjects of the day, the things that mattered to us. Not like the Lions losing another. I was at a friend of mine's house, and I said, I got to go. Do you think there's any chance the Lions could lose? What were we up by, like 15 points or something like that? And he says, no, I have not a chance. I said, okay, I'm going to go home. If you're not from around here, if you're listening somewhere on the other side of the world, don't worry about it. Just a Detroit, sports thing. Anyway, here's our deal. I'm going to introduce some subjects, although if you, in the meantime, would like to initiate, and, no one's done that in a long time. People used to do that. While I was yakking away, I forget, what do they call that? There's something in the, how come I don't know this, in the talk show biz where, your monologue, that's it, that's what the, Letterman and the rest of them do. While they're giving their monologue, that listeners would call in and say, I want to talk about, do not talk about the Lions, all right? And that's the football team, folks, if you're from, I don't know, people are listening in Finland, people are listening in Mexico, people are listening. I wonder, is our listener still in Antarctica? That was actually a couple of years ago, so I can't imagine he's still there. I said I didn't believe it because, people can write in and they could say they're from anywhere. Hey, I'm listening to you in Bucharest, right? And actually they're in Southgate or something like that. So I wrote back to the guy. I said, how do I know you're really in Antarctica? And then, boom, here a couple of sweatshirts come from the U.S. Geological Survey, I guess is what they call it. Anyway, you can call us up and you can call from anywhere in the world. Of course, it might be a little expensive. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. If you'd like to email me, please do. calltalkyes@yahoo.com. calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I'll be trying to check Facebook every once in a while to see whether Jolene has posted anything about what's going on. Facebook.com/nightcall. We like likes. And I wanted to alert you to something that's happening in a couple of hours. In fact, I say this at the beginning of this taped interview that I'm going to air at 1 a.m. And this is absolutely incredible. It's a film, a documentary called The House That I Live In. And let's see. Let's get a little more. Never mind. I'm having, I got to do this all myself now, right? I got to check all of the email, the Facebook. I got to, getting your calls, by the way, are John and Calvin at 313-298-WRIF. But it's a film by Eugene Jarecki, and an incredible director, a lot of documentary films to his credit. And The House I Live In is about the drug war. Now, I say this at the beginning, kind of giving it away a little. But at the beginning of the interview, which will air at 1 a.m., I said I almost didn't watch what we call the screener. They send you a preview copy for you to watch, if you're going to do a review or something or an interview. And I thought, do I know a lot about the drug war? I do. I know a lot of stats. I know, how much money was spent, why it was initiated, who it discriminates against, all of that. So I thought, I don't have to watch this, because if you listen to these interviews, you may remember I've said I often don't listen to, or I'm sorry, I don't read the books ahead of time. I can't, what do I do? Maybe 85 interviews a year. I can't read 85 books. I don't have a staff. So I depend on the kind of general knowledge. And my way of asking questions to interview guests is like I was you. You know what I mean? In other words, I wouldn't even have to know the title of the book. I could have done it a long time. So I could say, did you write a book? Yes. What was the name of your book? Blah, 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 blah. Oh, it's about, I don't know, what? It's about the drug war. Said, oh, yeah, what's it called? The House I Live In. Where's the title come from? I don't understand that. Tell me about the drug war. What's your particular approach on it? So I wouldn't have to see the film. I did. I saw it through the credits, and even the credits were incredible. So this film is going to start Friday, December 7th at the main theater in Royal Oak. And you can go to, it's on Facebook, but you can also go to thehouseilivein.org, I believe it is. Yeah, thehouseilivein.org. Well, hey, we can go to my website and check that out for sure. And my website is Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. And indeed, it is thehouseilivein.org. And even the name, like I say, has an interesting little wrinkle to it. So I'll be airing that at 1 a.m. It'll also be on the podcast that Calvin and John will be putting up and available through WRIF.com or through my website as well. And that should be by Monday. So check that out. And I'm going to keep, I think, talking about that because, well, one of the stats that comes out of it, and we all know a lot of money has been spent on the drug war. Drugs have won. I'm going to give this all away. But one of the things that I said to Eugene Jarecki, the director and the producer and the writer of The House I Live In, is that I said, right now, I have no idea how to get any cocaine. Not the slightest idea. I have no one I know that tells me is using cocaine. I have no idea where to get any heroin. But I'm willing to bet that in 12 hours, I could find cocaine, and in 24 hours, I could find heroin. I mean, that's how plentiful it is. And the big stats are we have spent $1 trillion and have arrested 45 million people for using drugs. John Sinclair, who from Detroit, the manager of the legendary MC5 and an advocate of marijuana legalization, said they put people in jail, including him, for a while, for smoking flowers. He said, what about that hard stuff? I mean, could anything be worse? I mean, are they really trying to protect us? Is that it? They don't want us to become addicted to heroin or to use it or to use substances like cocaine or methamphetamines. I mean, it all sounds like a bad idea, right? Although the vast majority probably, they should have been asked them this. But I suspect 90-95% of the way drugs are done is use, not abuse. Same thing with alcohol, right? Another very, very, I mean, that we all know these arguments, particularly here on WRIF, that the damage done and the addiction from alcohol makes cocaine and heroin and the rest of that stuff, like nothing in comparison, right? But so they are trying to protect us from that small percentage of people that get in a lot of trouble because of abuse. And people, of course, alcohol. I mean, how many people don't know someone who hasn't had problems with alcohol? There's very few people, certainly not me, that don't know someone in their family that's had alcohol problems. That, I mean, how many of us know a friend or a family member, a father, a brother, sister, mother, that's a recovering alcoholic? I mean, the millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of people. And, you know, and it's legal, so you don't have that many addicts by far. But then, you know, these arguments, you've heard them 100 times, 1920s, then all the crooks come in. Same thing here. Except we have frittered away $1 trillion, harmed irreparably millions, tens of millions of people, making them criminals because they wanted to change their consciousness, or they wanted to self-medicate, or they wanted to medicate. Think about the difference. Or whatever. It's none of our business. You know, it's none of my business if you want to have, you know, I mean, if you're a guy, you know the women in your life count the drinks you're having. You know, they say, you know, that's your third drink. I think, she's counting? Yeah, of course she's counting, right? Maybe guys do that for some women as well. But mostly, you know, guys tell me that women do that. So, but it is her business. Yeah, it's my wife. And she's concerned about, you know, am I going to be able to drive? What about my health? You know, if I have an alcoholic? Well, I don't, you know, I can say it. My father was a recovering alcoholic. I'm a very, very moderate drinker. Yeah, but I think it's always in the back of my wife's head. You know, how come he's, you know how that goes. So, but it is not the state's business. We decided that in the 1930s when we re-legalized alcohol. What's any different as an intoxicating, dangerous substance, a potentially intoxicating, dangerous substance, with any of the, you know, opiates or anything like that? Well, all right. I'm giving away the whole show at 1 a.m. You can remember, too, if you can't stay up that late, you can hear it again tomorrow on the podcast. Or you can hear the podcast anytime. In fact, you go to my website, there, you can go to all of them. You go back years, I think they're there. All right, so what about the weather? You know, remember, there's an old saying, everybody talks about the weather, but nobody does anything about it. Well, in a way, that's more true now than ever. Because we have, I hope, finally come to the realization that the weather patterns that we're experiencing aren't just the, you know, the variations that one has experienced even in a lifetime. I mean, maybe they seem more intense if you're, say, 17, 18 years old. But if you're 38 or 48 or 58 and you're listening, you've seen summers when it was 108, and you've seen winters when it's 6 below, and tornadoes every 10, 15 years come blowing through Detroit and what have you. But we've seen patterns now where storms become more and more severe, whether it's Hurricane Sandy or the storms that are hitting the Northwest now, or any number of other, you know, hurricanes in, you know, that have hit New Orleans and other places. And it, you know, occurs to me. Here you have all these climatologists, men and women who have trained to look at modeling and statistics for weather and climate, and they say it's all changing, and it's because of humans burning fossil fuels. So suddenly, the right wing got a hold of this. I don't get it. It's not like the declaration that there is global warming, that there is climate change, and that it's human caused, had a political content to it, other than what was embossed on it by these crazy right-wingers. Well, there's two aspects to it. One, it's these right-wingers, these talk show hosts and all that, and I always remember one of them saying, they're trying to take away your SUV. So there it is. There you go. Everything was fine until Al Gore or somebody like that got all of these thousands and thousands and thousands of climatologists all over the world to be part of this enormous conspiracy to take away your big fossil fuel burning big old honko, you know, SUV. I mean, it's crazy on the face of it. Yet it has gained so much legs. But then when you get just a little bit deeper in it, what do you find? And here's what's going on. This was from the Washington Post. The climate skeptic group, that's what they're calling skeptics. They're, you know, they don't believe that there's actually climate change. But are they still around? They're rapidly beginning to leave the scene as the weather gets worse and worse, right? I mean, some of it, we're getting the upside of global warming right now. It's going to be 60 tomorrow. Climate skeptic group works to reverse renewable energy mandates. That come clear? We had in Michigan in our last election in November, Proposition 3 that said a mere 25% of energy generated in the state of Michigan should be come from renewable energy, from the sun, from water, windmills, stuff like that. Wow, how crazy, huh? That maybe we could just put up a windmill. I say this last week or the week before that Thomas Edison had this idea, and he was shooting it by Henry Ford. Henry Ford was really interested. This is way back in the teens of the last century. And so Thomas Edison said they could put up a windmill at every single house and generate electricity and also power batteries for the car, charge batteries for a car. And he said, don't do this internal combustion thing. Whoa. And it's a long story. If you want to read an incredible book, and I can't remember the author, but it's called Internal Combustion. What a story. It's absolutely incredible. And I interviewed the author a few years ago or something like that. But so the idea, imagine that. There would have been no wars for oil. We probably would have been saying Iraq, Iran. Where are those? Saudi Arabia? Would we have been spending hundreds of billions of dollars trying to secure American interests, which is actually the interest of ExxonMobil, right? But anyway, the Heartland Institute, that sounds nice, doesn't it? Actually, a friend of mine, Mike James, a restaurateur and actor in Chicago, an old pal of mine, has the Heartland Cafe up in the north side, but this has nothing to do with it. The Heartland Institute, and also he's a radio broadcaster, a libertarian think tank skeptical of climate change science, talk about giving libertarians a bad name, has joined with the Conservative American Legislative Exchange Council, which is ALEC. And I can't, this has so many asides. This has so many asides. And I don't have Jolene, who's out tonight. I don't have her to keep me on focus. So I'm going to go right by. But you go in all caps, just put in ALEC, A-L-E-C. And see what they're up to. Anyways, they've gotten together with ALEC to write model legislation aimed at reversing state renewable energy mandates across the country. And they put in a lot of money here in Michigan to defeat Proposition 3. Why in the world would they want to do this? Why wouldn't they want? Because whenever we've talked about this before, I said, doesn't it make sense to err on the side of caution? That's easily understandable, right? We can't go very wrong. We can't go very wrong with having non-fossil fuel burning cars and homes and all of that, right? Well, I mean, what's the downside of doing it? Oh, yeah. Thank you, John or Calvin. This is Movie Man Says Hi. Hi, Movie Man. Who do I know, Movie Man? Or is that Jolene's friend? I think so. Anyway, the author of Internal Combustion. Is this John? How do you know this? Why, Jolene and I, by the way, are going to be off next week. And I was joking with John about doing the show. Oh, he says he Googled it. All right. I thought he was, Edwin Black. It was written by Edwin Black. He also wrote a great book about IBM and the Nazis. So anyway, all right. See, she'd be saying, come on, Pete, what about this? So, the Heartland Institute, this right-wing think tank, and this far-right-wing American Legislative Exchange Council, they have something called the Electricity Freedom Act. Well, whenever you hear that, look out. By the way, we actually have someone besides me has seen the house I live in, the anti-drug war movie. So, Brian, stay on the line. I'll get to you, even if it takes a while. It's adopted by the ALEC Council's Board of Directors. It would repeal state standards requiring utilities to get a portion of their electricity from renewable power, calling it, quote, essentially a tax on consumers of electricity. Now, why would that be? 29 states in the District of Columbia, not Michigan, have binding renewable standards. In the absence of federal climate legislation, these initiatives have become the subject of intense political battles. Well, who in the world could this be between? Let's read further into this Washington Post article. The Legislative Council, or ALEC, is a conservative-leaning group. I mean, if they leaned any more conservative, they'd fall over on their dead asses. They're a group of state legislators from all 50 states, and this is all by the ALEC. It's financed by the Koch brothers. If you don't know who they are, look them up. K-O-C-H. We're not going back to cocaine. K-O-C-H. A couple of billionaires in the top 10 richest men in the country, and they want to, they want even more money. I mean, they give new meaning to the word greedy. Anyways, ALEC lost some corporate sponsors early this year because of its role promoting stand your ground laws that allow the use of force in self-defense without first retreating when faced with a serious threat. That's the Trayvon Martin killing. But the involvement of the Heartland Institute, which posted a billboard in May comparing those who believe in global warming to the terrorist Unabomber, shows the breadth of the conservative effort to undermine environmental initiatives on the state and federal level. In many cases, the groups involved accept, money from oil, gas, and coal companies. I forgot about coal. That compete against renewable energy suppliers. Oh, okay. Now it's beginning to make sense. So on one hand, we have people like you and me, but that have become active. You and I think we ought to live on a clean planet, that we ought to not be poisoning the nest, soiling the nest in the way we're doing, the way that industrial capitalism has done for the last couple of hundred years. So there's us, and then there's these activists who are part of the environmental community who want to not ruin our planet. And some people say we're at a tipping point. I don't know. You know, we don't know that for sure. I wouldn't like to find out. So that's what I mean about erring on the side of caution. The Michigan referendum proposition would have had 25% energy produced by renewables, and I can't remember the date, but quite far off. Or I'm saying, why don't they have it like 100% in 5 years? I mean, things are that critical, according to a lot of scientists, and I don't know for sure. I'm just believing them. So who are you going to believe? Scientists, climatologists, men and women who have devoted their lives to studying this, or guys from the oil, gas, and coal companies that compete against renewable energy suppliers? Well, let's look at this Heartland Institute and see how objective they are. Remember, the environmentalists, they don't hire anybody to go around and say, oh, you know, coal burning is bad, burning gasoline is bad, and it's creating global warming. This came from the science community. But the Heartland Institute received more than $7.3 million from ExxonMobil. It's a big racket. And these, I mean, I don't know. I mean, how either could these corporations like ExxonMobil, who is one of the wealthiest, is the single wealthiest corporation in the world, or this institute, how could these people be such whores? I mean, with the tip of the hat to sex workers, I'm not even, not even putting them down. And let's see. Oh, and they got nearly $14.5 million from foundations affiliated with Charles G. and David H. Can we all say the last name together? Koch. You're the Koch brothers, whose firm, Koch Industries, has substantial oil and energy holdings. What a racket these people have perpetrated on us. Not only do they control this small 1%, control the vast amount of wealth in this world to the detriment of probably 80% of the population of the world. Not only do their financial shenanigans wind up destroying economies all across the planet, meaning billion or a couple billion people live in absolute penury, poverty beyond anything we could imagine. I'm talking about, you know, Africa and Asia and Latin America. They also are defending the destruction of the environment. This is the 1%. This is who these right-wingers represent. This is who they will defend no matter what, no matter anybody tries to limit them in any way, even to the point where they say, wait, I have a little more regulations on these guys' financial transactions, because every time they don't have any transaction, they're ruining the economy. They're destroying the economy. They always wind up okay. Maybe a few of them go under, but hey, most of them wind up being as rich as they ever were. Well, you may have been, if you just tuned in, missing the voice of Jillian Jordan. I sure do. She's off tonight. Sick dog again. We're all hoping for Etta's recovery. But it's going to be you and me. So I'm Peter Werby. Give me a call, 313-298-WRIF. I usually go through the break, but I want to hear about this. There was a movie, in case you're just tuning in. It's called The House I Live In, and it's about the failed drug war. It hasn't failed for everybody. I mean, it's one of the things. We spend $1 trillion. Another one of those wealth transfer things. That's what taxes are, right? We earn money, and a portion of it is taken by government, and government spends it. And we're real happy when they spend it on roads and schools and first responders and sometimes even the space program, although I'm a little shaky on that one always. But in any event, this is $1 trillion of our tax money. Could we have used that for anything else? Let me see. Well, let me say this. If Bush hadn't have given the tax break to the ultra wealthy, if he hadn't started these wars based on lies, and if they had, pardon me, hadn't been for the war on drugs, think we would have been at this financial state right now? I don't think so. And the right wing, they support every single one of those things, right? Come hell or high water. But let's get Brian on the air. Hey, Brian, hi, it's Peter. You're on the air. Welcome. Where did you see the film? Brian, are you with me? Brian, are you with me? Am I doing something wrong? No. Huh. All right, you hold on, brother, and I'll figure this baby out. I'm going to do a little test here. Let's see. No, it's working, so I don't know. That was the test. All right, John, check out Brian, and then we'll get back to him in a minute because I'm interested to hear what he has to say about this new film. All right, one of the things that happened was as a result of all this global warming is the oceans are beginning to rise. You're beginning to have more intense storms, so we know what happened with megastorm Sandy or Hurricane Sandy. And it's much, much, much more. All right, he's ready. All right, let's do that. I can get to that part after the break. Let me try it again. Here is Brian in Brighton. Brian, hi, you're on the air.
How you doing?
Doing good. Where did you see this film? It hasn't even been released yet.
Oh, I seen it. My buddy's got, he burns me these DVDs and send them through the mail. And
yeah. Whoa, all right. Let's go no further. But go ahead. What'd you think about it?
Well, it was an interesting documentary. There's one scene where he is lying in one of those old mattresses with the spring, you know, where and then the bed sprung up while he was laying in it, while he was working off. And it was just a fantastic documentary.
What? This was a joke call, folks. What an idiot. All right. Never mind. 313-298-WRIF. It wasn't unfunny. You know, I don't even, in some ways, I don't even mind. I like jokes, but, yeah, we can just get a little time here, and it probably isn't worth doing that. Anything. Okay. All right. Where was it? Oh, yeah, yeah. The storm. In the east and everything that it created. One of the things that happens that in East Rockaway, New York, the water flowing out of this sewage plant in Nassau County turns out to be, all right, hope you're not eating, this greenish-gray soup of partially treated human waste, a sign of an environmental and public health disaster that officials say will be one of the most enduring and expensive effects of Hurricane Sandy. In the months since the storm, hundreds of millions of gallons of raw and partly raw sewage from Bay Park and other crippled treatment plants have flowed into the waterways in New York and New Jersey, exposing flaws in the region's wastewater infrastructure that could take several years and billions of dollars to fix. In New York State alone, Governor Andrew M. Cuomo has estimated that about $1.1 billion will be needed to repair plants. And, of course, none of the states have it. Where is all this money in the richest country in the world? And it talks about everything that it has to do about all the motors and electrical equipment must be raised above the newly established flood levels because they're getting higher. Circuitry must be made waterproof. Dams and levees may have to be built at some treatment plants to keep the rising waters at bay. You know, in the Thames River in London, they have these barriers that come up if there's going to be this surge. And who knows, maybe they have to do that. Although people have projected that if global warming continues, if the ice mass continues to melt at the poles and all that, that good parts of the coastline on all over the world could be underwater. Because, well, here, John, who's always looking things up in Google, I don't know what, where is Michigan at? Aren't we at like at about 900 feet about above sea level? Because, you know, then it goes down, keeps going down, towards the sea, over Niagara Falls, a couple hundred feet or something like that. But, you know, if you're in Florida, you're at one, right, you're like 1 foot above sea level. Well, if the sea rises 3 feet, it's gone. A lot of island nations in the Pacific are going to go away as well. When these plants are fully functioning, they treat incoming sewage to remove solid waste and toxic substances and kill bacteria before it's discharged into the ocean or a bay. When the plants are shut down, the raw sewage goes into waterways in the same condition as when it comes in. At least six sewage plants were crippled by the storm surges that swamped motors and caused short circuits in the electrical equipment. So where are we going to get all this money? Because now we're talking about this financial cliff, right? We're going to go over this cliff if we don't fix this impasse in Washington, the fiscal cliff. It's called FISCAL, fiscal, not physical, but fiscal. Someone remember saying, "What's a physical cliff? How are we going to go over a physical cliff as opposed to like a metaphoric cliff or an imaginary cliff?" This is fiscal, having to do with the finances. Well, the big 1,500-pound gorilla in the room is the military budget, and neither party is willing to talk about cuts there. In fact, the Republicans, remember, even though the Pentagon said we don't need more money, they said they were going to raise the military budget because we have all these enemies we have to fight, like the Soviet. No, wait a minute, they're gone. So we we got to keep all these troops in Europe, right? Because what if the Soviet? Oh yeah, right. What is that all for? Oh, well, yeah, the military-industrial complex. It's sort of like the prison-industrial complex, isn't it? John tells me Detroit is 581 feet above sea level, looking up other major cities now. All right, you do that. We'll talk more about where can we get some money that we need for the where do we get the money for the things we need and cut loose the things we don't need. So open lines, and here is Mr. Announcer to tell us where to call.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Inhabitants of Earth, you can run, but you cannot. What are you doing?
I'm watching Netflix on my smartphone, dude.
What?
I can instantly watch as many TV episodes and movies as I want.
You don't fear for your life?
Yeah, not really. Our atmosphere is eventually going to kill you anyway.
Nonsense. Our anatomy is...
There you go. Faster than I thought.
Instantly watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on all kinds of devices for only $8 a month with Netflix. Start your free trial today. See terms of use.
If you're like me, you probably had to do something hard today. I mean, personally, I hate washing out socks. That's why we made Geico.com so exceedingly easy. Easy to see how much you could save on car insurance. Easy to review and update your policy. Change of address. Just a few clicks and you're done. Visit Geico.com today because life is hard enough. I mean, I don't even wear socks.
Put your hand on your wallet, because they're coming for your money.
I'm bigger than you. I'm higher in the food chain.
Where's the rich? What are they going to say?
Get in my belly.
So here's your choice.
Tasty.
Welcome back. This is Night Call Show. Julene Jordan off tonight. I'm Peter Werby. Open lines at 313-298-WRIF. And that is, she always says this. How come I can't memorize this after all these years? 313-298-9743. I'm saying that this money should come from a couple of places. One, a substantially reduced military budget. Does anybody think we really need to spend $1 trillion a year? In fact, I'll talk about a little of one of the items that's in the hopper that absolutely unneeded. But in terms of eating the rich, a 38-year-old flight attendant is suing prominent Michigan billionaire real estate developer A. Alfred Taubman, claiming he fondled her, tried to rip off her clothing during flights, and told her she ruined her life when she got pregnant by somebody else and should have had an abortion. Highland, Michigan resident Nicole D. Rock, that's a great name, in a federal lawsuit filed Thursday, is seeking $29 million in damages on claims Taubman, 88, sexually discriminated, harassed, and wrongfully terminated her after 6 years of employment with the Bloomfield Hills Residence Airline Company, as own airline, right? he denied the allegations. So these are only allegations. This is not the important thing. I'm not trying to smear the guy because, you know, we don't know what happened. And Nicole Rock, who began working for Taubman's company as a flight attendant in 2005, alleges her civil rights were violated by the Taubman Air Terminals, Inc., CEO and president during the course of her employment. And she was forced to, quote, endure horrific illegal acts by defendants of a graphic and sexually harassing nature. She was subjected to repeated comments, innuendos, advances, and other offensive conduct of a sexual nature, close quote, by Taubman. Taubman, according to Rock, fondled her, forcefully kissed her, violently tore buttons off her blouse, and ripped a hole in her pantyhose in attempts to force her to participate in sexual acts, among other things. Lawsuit also said during a flight, Taubman forced his hands down the front of Rock's dress and proceeded to forcefully kiss her on the mouth without her consent. Taubman violently tore buttons off of Rock's blouse. Now, that's just what she says, right? But this is more. This is like more like eat the rich stuff. So, all right. So, $29 million. Where did they get that figure from? I mean, you got to figure damages. So, where did the damages come from? Well, the attorney. Where is his first name? There, Warnicke is his last name. Oh, Thomas Warnicke said his client isn't currently working, and this has been emotionally devastating for her. Warnicke said he arrived at the $29 million figure because of Taubman's net worth. Forbes magazine in 2012 estimated his wealth at $2.9 billion. We're seeking 1% of his net worth. Can you imagine that? Why didn't he just say, all right, here, take it? You know. He went to jail, Taubman did. He served 9.5 months in a prison after being convicted by a federal jury in 2001 for fixing prices at Sotheby's auction house, which he owned. And he did a couple of years there. When does it say he was? Oh, he's convicted in 01, but then released in May of 2003. What is with these guys? They got all the money in the world and they're rigging auctions? I don't get it. So we don't know, you know, I don't know whether he did what he's accused by in the suit, but the deal is, if you could imagine that, $29 million, that is, I'm always talking about the suburb in which Jalene and I live. That is, the $29 million figure is more than twice, and this is 1% of Alfred Taubman's wealth. It's more than twice the annual budget. And we've been laying off cops and, well, I mean, they're first responders. They do police work and EMS and fire. So this is part of the problem. I mean, part of the problem is this impacted wealth that I'm always talking about. So an 88-year-old guy has $2.9 billion, and if someone took $29 million from him, he'd still have 99% of that. I mean, I can't even do the math on it. Remember, Jillian never lets me do math on the air. And I don't know why this reminded me of this. You know, this time of year, if you look at any newspaper, and particularly the New York Times, which I do all the time because it has the most complete stories on things, they're advertising always watches. Watches and watches and watches. And I'm thinking, man, you know, last watch I bought, the truth, at Target, $7.50. And I bought it 6 years ago, and it's still ticking, right? $7.50. So that does it. I mean, I don't even wear it. When my trips to out of the country, you got to know more what time it is. So that's why I wanted to watch for that. So how about this? This is in the New York Times. It's on the back page of the Business Day section of the New York Times. And maybe if I'm saying this wrong, someone can help me. But there's this watch called, where is the name? Patek Philippe, P-A-T-E-K. First word and probably Felipe, the second one. They're the one that's saying you don't own a watch, you're saving it for the next generation. So they're showing one here, a very fine 18-karat gold chronograph wristwatch with perpetual calendar and moon phase, circa 1955. So the thing is almost, 60 years old. So it's this old watch, right? So, you know, it must be worth, you know, maybe $15, $25. You're not going to believe this. And think about that. Someone is actually going to buy this. And what a spread here. It's worth $250,000 to $350,000. And they're going to sell it. This is from the International Auctioneers and Appraisers, Bonhams.com. You can go, you know, like John Bonham, the drummer. Bonhams.com. You can go look it up. So somebody's going to pick up a watch for $350,000 where we're laying off first responders. Is anything wrong here, or is that just the way it goes, you know? Well, I don't think that's just the way it goes. I think that's the way it's going, and we have to decide whether we're going to live in a society where people are wearing $250,000 watches and other people are working for $7.75 an hour, or not. It's as simple as that. Let's get some calls on the air. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Jerry in Royal Oak. Jerry, thanks for calling. Peter Werby here with you, and you're on the air.
Hey, thanks a lot for taking my call. A couple things. You were talking about climate change earlier and saw a big story or a story a couple weeks ago on Good Morning Sunday. And they interviewed several scientists from all over the country, all over the world, actually. Some, you know, the cinders of it, and but basically most of the scientists felt that we were heavy into this climate change, and they blamed it 90 to 98% on humans.
Sure.
We're driving too many cars. And when we think about what we got about 7 billion people on Earth right now, probably 8 billion by 2050, you know, talking about you know, a watch that costs $300,000. We waste so much stuff here in this country that just the waste, the money that we could save. I mean, I was thinking about it earlier, and I was thinking about all this stuff, and I'm thinking, you know, we all probably have, like, 10 T-shirts that we beg people not to give us another one.
Sure.
And there's probably people around the world. I was thinking about it. Because I'm kind of in the green movement and thinking, you know, hey, I think we can go to more renewable energy sources and that kind of thing and create more green jobs with reuse and that kind of thing. And I was just thinking, you know, if we got 10 t-shirts, you know, there's people around the world that's only got one. And we're constantly filling up these landfills. And so really, folks, it's up to us. This whole climate change, they were talking about how these storms are going to get worse, you know, where we may be getting 2 a year now, we're going to get 4 a year, and they're going to get even worse.
We're in kind of a favored little position of the planet, but we shouldn't count on it. We sure shouldn't count on that. Let me tell you this, though, Jerry. You were saying is that they were, the show you're watching, they were presenting the people that were saying that it's human-caused climate change, and then they had these climate deniers. That's one of the things that the mainstream media does. They give equal treatment. There is no respect or regard whatsoever for the climate change deniers whatsoever within the scientific community, because they know that, again, you know, hats off to sex workers, but they're prostitutes for the fossil fuel industry. And yet the media says, oh, we got to give both sides of it, right? Well, I don't know that you got to give it equal sides. If oftentimes when I'm on the other side of it, understand, you know, they won't give the other side even a voice. So I'm not trying to say that we shouldn't consider what they have to say. But, you know, when every major scientific group in the world says that there's human-caused climate change, I think we maybe ought to take it for granted that they're correct, huh?
You know, they're not waking up on the right side of the bed or whatever is going on, lack of oxygen. But I think that it's clear, like you said, that most scientists around the world know that it's us that's causing all the concern. If we don't change just our, you know, small behavior things we could do, like, you know, ways that we could, you know, save, conserve on energy use and be more energy efficient. I mean, I was in Paris in 1997, walked in the hotel room, the lights come on. When I left, the lights go out. And, I mean, you go here in America and we go into, we cut all the lights on, we leave them all on, we leave all the TV on, we leave everything on when we leave. And we're just, you know, we're not good managers of our energy, and we wonder about why we're already always in oil wars and all that.
Sure.
So it's kind of cool. I just hope that we can become more responsible
because we need to be. You know, what you're talking about, individual choices, individual responsibility is very important. For one thing, when you commit exemplary acts, in other words, acts that you would like everyone to choose, you can set a pattern. But ultimately, it's got to be social policy. But I think individual acts which have a culmination of, you know, with a lot of people can drive social policy. But we got to really make sure that we're not just, if you and I recycle almost everything and we compost our garbage and we refill this and that, that's all good. Because for one of the things it does, it defines us. I mean, that's one of the things you're doing by your choices. If you're just, flagrant misuser of stuff, well, then, what kind of person are you? All right, thank you very much for joining us. 313-298-WRIF. Got some open lines as well, and I'll get to your other calls in a second. But one of the things that's happening, if you live in certain areas, you have flood insurance, right? And it's through the federal government's National Flood Insurance Program, which, of course, we've all heard about because, no, almost no one here has because it's not an item. But to hear, this was an article in the New York Times on November 28th. It's called End Federal Flood Insurance. And it says, it's no surprise that it can be very expensive to live near the ocean. Well, we think so because, man, wouldn't that be great to have a place on the ocean? We always see that in the movies, right? Particularly California. But the article says, but it may come as a surprise to American taxpayers that they are on the hook for at least, you ready for this figure? $527 billion of vulnerable assets in the nation's coastal floodplains. That's like half a trillion. It says, you read that right. $527 billion, which is just a portion of the program's overall liability of $1.25 trillion, second only to Social Security in the liabilities on the government's ledgers last year, according to government data. The flood insurance program was created by Congress in 1968 to fill a void. Because of the risk, few carriers provided flood insurance. It was not a good place to build anything because you could get flooded out. Now private insurers offer flood insurance in a partnership with the government, but get this, we taxpayers shoulder all the risk. It's turned out to be a bad bet, it says. The program is $18 billion in debt, a sum the government acknowledges probably never will be paid back by premiums, and is likely to need a new multi-billion dollar infusion to pay the claims that have come from Hurricane Sandy. It says it's long past time for the government to stop subsidizing homes and business owners who live and build in the dangerous flood zone. So what do you think? Should we just say, hey, too bad, you got to move a little inland? And they say, the authors, homeowners and businesses should be responsible for purchasing their own flood insurance on the private market if they can find it, which I don't think they'll be able to. If they can't, then the market is telling them that where they live is too dangerous. Now, this sounds like a libertarian argument, right? So all you Republicans ought to be able to get behind this. If they choose to live in harm's way, they should bear the cost of that risk, not the taxpayers, and not us. Government's primary role is ensuring the safety of its citizens, so the government's subsidizing of risky behavior is completely backward. What do you think? I mean, on one hand, those communities were exactly that. They were long-standing communities where families lived through the generations and businesses and what have you. And these folks are saying, pull the rug out from under them. We just can't afford them. And particularly if we're looking at climate change, we're looking at a rise in the seas, even on foot would be, pretty deadly. Your thoughts? 313-298-WRIF. Here's Fred in Detroit. Fred, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Peter. Hi. Like I was telling the guy who answers the calls, I've been hearing Snyder talk about how safe fracking is nowadays, especially in Michigan, with no major incidents.
Yeah, let's tell people this is, and I can't think of what's the gas fracturing, right? Where they send these chemicals down into these gas deposits, which drives the gas up, and the critics say it's just doing incredible damage to the environment. All the energy companies and corporations, they say, oh, no, we're going to get cheap gas. You see all those ads on television, right?
Right. Well, what you don't hear about is all the water being used. All the fresh water, groundwater, and then you have the lakes at low levels now. It's a lot of emission there.
Right.
All the prop up the natural gas industry. And I also wanted to say that I learned a long time ago that, it wasn't just about the scientists reporting, but there were people running around this planet with cameras reporting on glaciers and ice shells and things like that melting. You know, and they say a picture is worth a thousand words, you know, and somebody should have been holding these pictures up years ago to these conservative faces and say, argue with that. Or why don't you just fly to yourself and check it out?
Well, Fred, you are affected by logic, which will never get you anywhere with those people. They just, they're contrarians. I don't get it. There's something in their psyche. Actually, you know, there's another documentary coming to the main theater besides this anti-drug war film that's starting next Friday. In fact, they both may be starting, and I can't remember what the name of the other one is, but it's film footage of exactly what you're saying. You ever get out there to the main in Royal Oak?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, you should do it. It's a nice little venue, you know, a lot of great restaurants in Royal Oak, and take in the film, yeah.
Okay, then. Well, I've been there about a couple of decades ago, but I'll try to go see this.
All right. Thanks, Fred. Thanks for calling. Here is Mike in Fenton. Hi, Mike. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
Doing good. Thanks.
About the dog first, I mean, she might want to change this food. Could be the food. Usually sickness comes from the food.
What we're talking about here, folks, is Jalene's dog is sick and has been sick for a while, and that's why she's off. Well, I don't know. Sometimes it does happen. I think it could be something else, but whatever. What's up with you tonight?
Well, I wanted to talk about, I heard some stuff about George Bush and Cheney, but I've seen John Bonham in person, and that he was the most amazing drummer I ever seen, and that was worth more than any watch you could ever get.
There you go. Yeah, right.
And another thing, Peter, is my wife's mother used to be the personal secretary to Tom, and she never said anything bad about that guy.
To who? To who?
To Mr. Todman.
Oh, to Alfred Todman. Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
He owns a bunch of strip malls and malls that dudes stinking rich. But as far as George Bush and Mr. Cheney, I heard last week on NPR radio, the British news, that they were talking about they were in the UN and that they had a hearing on them too, and that they were found guilty of war crimes. So I'm thinking maybe that's why we don't see them very much, and you don't hear nothing about it on the American news. So them guys, they might be wanting to take them over there and have a little talk with them two clowns.
Well, there's a couple of people, certainly Henry Kissinger. And in fact, the man who directed this film that's opening at the main theater, The House I Live In, the anti-drug war film, he also has a documentary called The Trial of Henry Kissinger. And Henry Kissinger can't go to any number of countries in the world because he would be taken off to trial in these particular countries because of what he did in Vietnam, what he did in Chile, and all this. So, and the same thing with George Bush. He's got to be a little careful where he winds up. But I don't know. I can't imagine somehow that they would grab an American citizen and put him on trial, particularly one of that stature, whatever we may think of them politically. All right, Mike. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Got an email here from George at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. They're, according to Politico, which is a website, reporting that a framework for a fiscal deal is emerging, including massive cuts to Medicare. I don't know, George. Call me naive. Go ahead. Okay. You called me naive. I just can't believe that the Democrats or the Republicans would take a swipe at something so popular. And there's gotten to be something kind of dirty about the word entitlement. I mean, like somehow we're not entitled to a comfortable old age. Are you not supposed to say that? Senior citizen, what's the other thing? Elder, all right. But let's call it old age the way they always did. That you got to wind up in the poorhouse like you did before the New Deal programs in the 1930s. That you got to depend on your family that's already financially stressed for medical care. But here is what Politico says, and George sent this along. Cut through the fog, and here's what to expect. Taxes will go up just shy of $1.2 trillion, the middle ground of what President Barack Obama and what Republicans say they could stomach. entitlement programs, mainly Medicare, will be cut by no less than $400 billion and perhaps a lot more to get Republicans to swallow those tax hikes. Well, I don't know whether this is the case or not. We don't know what's going on. This, again, if you're not really quite clear, but if there's not some legislation passed, all of our taxes are going to go up. The average person, depending on where you look, somewhere between $2,000 and $3,500, and the rich guys, their taxes are going to go up. There's going to be cuts to the military, and there's going to be cuts to the so-called entitlement programs. Although Social Security, which the Republicans are after and want to turn into a private enterprise, that doesn't even figure in the deficit. So it's a lot of nonsense. But when we come back, I'll tell you how the majority of American people feel about Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Meantime, give us a call.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this. How would you like to see customers through your door today and the next day and the day after that? I have the answer you're looking for. RiffDeals.com. Hey, you're online now. Just click on the banner in the player window to find out more. Remember, there's no upfront cost to you. It's a partnership, but your success is the goal. WRAF's marketing pros work with you to develop the perfect deal. Then RiffDeals.com uses the power of on-air, online, and social media marketing to help you reach new customers. Oh, did I mention that you get a check within 10 days of your successful deal running? That's cash in your pocket and customers in the door.
Geico says, let's make life simpler.
Look, I'm all for modern conveniences. But ask yourself, do you really need a blender with 23 buttons just to chop an onion? At Geico, we think life should be simpler. So we make it super simple to save on car insurance. Just one click and you could be on your way to saving hundreds. Come on, people. Life doesn't have to be that complicated.
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The 12 Days of Riffmas are back. Keep listening for your next chance to win. Details online at WRIF.com. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julene.
All right, Julene is off tonight dealing with her sick dog, and I haven't looked at our Facebook recently. I don't know whether or not she has posted or not. In fact, she hasn't is a little worrisome to me, actually. I hope nothing bad is happening. Let's go down. Oh, never mind. I'm Facebook. She does it. Well, nothing yet here from her. Okay, it's you and me then, and we wish the best to Jalene and her wonderful 5-year-old boxer, Etta. There are some open lines, so grab them at 313-298-WRIF. Well, here's what the vast majority of American citizens, not the vast, unfortunately, a large majority of U.S. citizens would like to see higher taxes on the rich and oppose cuts to Medicare. And as an answer to the U.S. deficit, that's according to a poll released Wednesday by the Washington Post and ABC News. Now, get this. Roughly 60% of those asked stated that they would like to see higher income taxes on those in the higher income brackets, $250,000 and greater. Only 37% opposed the progressive tax system that would increase taxes for the wealthy. I don't get it. Who are these 37%? I could understand if it was like 1%. All these people that are going to get taxed, they're going to say, you know what, I don't think we should be taxed. Because who wants to give up their money? And this is an important little piece here, too. But is there any of you one-third out there that think that the wealthy shouldn't be taxed more? Maybe they've just been taxed enough. They won't have enough to buy those $350,000 wristwatches, right? But 73% of Democrats say they support higher taxes on the rich. 63% of independents support higher taxes on the rich. And guess what percentage of Republicans oppose greater taxes on the rich? Almost 60%. What is with these people? I don't get it. I just don't get it. Are they that protective of their betters? Are they fearful? They become kind of like these mean daddy substitutes, and they don't want to get daddy mad by trying to take away his money or something like that that they've taken away? I don't get it. I just don't get it. But one of the things I wanted to tell you about, though, is tonight at 1 a.m., I'm going to be airing an interview I did earlier this week with Eugene Jarecki. And he is the director and writer and producer of The House I Live In. It's going to be at the main theater. And it's this incredible film about the U.S. war on drugs. And I said at the beginning of the show, you may have missed that, that I thought I knew all there was to know, you know, being a know-it-all. And, boy, it was absolutely incredible. Let me see if I can remember by memory who were the executive producers are. Brad Pitt. Oh, what's going on in my brain? Charles Simmons, Danny Glover, and there may be a fourth prominent person as well. This thing's really well put together. In fact, pretty incredible. All right, so why in the world? I mean, are there any Republicans out there that want to, 60% of Republicans that say they oppose higher taxes on the rich? Why? Why do you have this thing for the rich? You know that they're not creating new jobs. They're just sitting on billions. They're not just sitting it. They're investing it. But, additionally, two-thirds of Americans oppose a raise in Medicare eligibility age from 65 to 67 as proposed by many Republican lawmakers. Only 30% of Americans support it. I wonder how that comes down with these Republicans, because they're like an older bunch, right? I don't know. Maybe they're a little better on that. But they're so cruel. What's the chair of Goldman Sachs? Blankfein, isn't that his name? He was on CBS News. This, you know, you got the kids away from this son of a bitch. I don't know he's right wing, but he's a rich SOB. You know, he got bailed out with tens of billions of our tax dollars because he and companies like his company and ones like that screwed up the economy. And he's saying that they ought to raise the eligibility age. I mean, this guy have no shame? None whatsoever? This company that now earns, not brings in, but has profits in the billions. And he wants to take older people who are still slaving away somewhere in a factory or in a waitress or something like that, make them wait another 2 years. These people have no heart. That in the interview that I do with Eugene Jarecki, he talks about what's his phrase? Is it a country without compassion? You know, it's not a country. I should have maybe brought that up. It's not a country without compassion. It really is a minority of people that don't have it, and they're located heavily among the Republicans and the wealthy, for sure. And the Republicans are just the political mouthpiece of the wealthy. Now, get this. So one of the things, these people are just getting taxed to death. So am I. The rich people are getting taxed to death. You and I are getting taxed to death, right? Middle class, working class, all of that. But here, just quoting the New York Times, hand over fist, aren't I? This is from November 29th. Most Americans in 2010 paid far less in total taxes, federal, state, and local, than they would have paid 30 years ago. Whoa, wait a minute. Doesn't that confound what we think? Let me read it again. Most Americans in 2010 paid far less is the phrase here, in total taxes, federal, state, and local, than they would have paid 30 years ago. According to the analysis by the New York Times, the combination of all income taxes, sales taxes, and property taxes took a smaller share is the word phrase here, of their income than it took from households with the same inflation-adjusted income in 1980. So the taxes are going down, the wealth is going up. So what's the problem? How come we don't all have more money? They, the 1%, they all have more money. Here's the deal. Households earning more than $200,000 benefited from the largest percentage declines in total taxation as a share of income. Middle-income households benefited, too. More than 85% of households with earnings above $25,000 paid less in total taxes than comparable households in 1980. But And this is what's so screwy about it. Lower-income households, however, saved little or nothing. Many pay no federal income taxes, but they do pay a range of other levies like federal payroll taxes, sales taxes, and local property taxes. Only about half of taxpaying households with incomes below $25,000 paid less in 2010. So the poorest did the worst, and guess who did the best, right? The uneven decline is a result of two trends. Congress cut federal taxation at every income level over the past 30 years. State and local taxes, meanwhile, increase for most Americans. Those taxes generally take a larger share of income from those who make less, so the increases offset more and more of the federal savings at the lower levels of income. Man. All right. Let's take some more calls. Open lines at 313-298-WRIF. Here is Mike in Madison Heights. Mike, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, how's it going? First, I want to say I hope Jillian's dog gets better. You're speaking earlier about global warming.
Sure, we were talking about that earlier. Go ahead, though.
Your scientists have yet to discover how neural networks create self-consciousness, let alone how the human brain processes two of the dimensional retina images into three-dimensional phenomena known as perception. And you brazenly declare the seeing is believing? I mean, come on. Roswell.
It's all out there. The truth is out there, though, isn't it, Mike?
Maybe. I don't know.
All right. Thank you very much. If you can make me laugh, it's okay. Let's see. Did I say the wrong name here? Oh, yeah. What did I say? I said John Simmons or something like that. Anyway, the executive producers of The House I Live In, the new documentary opening December 7th at the Main Theater in Royal Oak, the anti-drug war documentary, is Brad Pitt, Danny Glover, Russell Simmons, and John Legend. Wow. I mean, that's quite a lineup. Okay, so everybody's got an idea about how we should solve this deficit and debt problems, right? And one of the things that a lot of these CEOs, that someone asked me the other day, what does that stand for? You know, the chief executive officer. And Blankfein, John, can you make sure I got the name right? I think that's what his name is. Maybe give me a first name from Goldman Sachs. They're these ultra wealthy guys. They're not just the 1%. 1%, I think, is, I don't know if they're 250,000 may just put you in the upper 2%. But, you know, 1% is like 500,000 and all. I mean, they don't even, you know, the people that are at the top of the pinnacle of the pyramid, the real ruling class, the ruling elite, they don't even go to parties with people making $500,000. You know, they employ people that make $500,000, if you're ready for that. Lloyd Blankfein. Did I say anything like that? I don't know. Lloyd Blankfein, who is the CEO of Goldman Sachs, and he is saying, and got, you know, billions and billions of dollars of bailout money, and now he's saying we ought to raise the eligibility age for grandpa, right? Well, here's the deal. A new report by the Institute for Policy Studies examines CEOs of publicly traded companies, ones that are in the stock market, who have endorsed what's called Fix the Debt. It's a campaign that these CEOs have gone on. And it finds that these CEOs, while calling for ordinary Americans to take cuts in Social Security and Medicare, are sitting, you ready for this again, on an average of $9 million each in retirement funds. That's what they're going to have when they retire. How about you? How about your parents? How about your grandparents? What does that come out to? What do you think they've got squirreled away for when the rug gets yanked out from under them, or they have to wait another couple of years, or Social Security is cut and what have you? Most are also running large deficits in their own employees' pension funds. This is sometimes difficult to sort through on the radio. If you read it, you go, wait a minute, what does that mean? They're shifting. Okay. It means that they have a fortune in retirement funds themselves. They do not have enough money in their own employee pension funds, and they're calling for this to come off. Well, here, I'll give you the quote here. Scott Klinger, a report co-author, said, "These CEOs paint a stark picture of hypocrisy," he says. "They are feathering their own retirement nests while trying to deny ordinary Americans, including their own employees, their hard-earned nest eggs. They're simply taking advantage of the so-called fiscal cliff to push the same old agenda of more corporate tax breaks while shifting the cost onto the poor and the elderly." I mean, this is the 19th century, folks. We're back there. The report focuses on the CEOs of major U.S. corporations who have endorsed the Fix the Debt campaign, which is currently conducting a nationwide advertising blitz to promote their solutions for the country's fiscal ills, which it doesn't say, but they created. The 71 Fix the Debt CEOs who lead the publicly traded companies have amassed an average $9 million in their company retirement funds of their own. A dozen have more than $20 million in their accounts. If each of them converted their assets to an annuity when they turned 65, they would receive a monthly check of at least $110,000 a year. No, not a year. Not a year. A month for life. The Fix the Debt CEO with the largest pension fund is Honeywell's David Coate, a longtime advocate of Social Security cuts. I'm going to keep saying, I don't care if I get fired. I'm just too angry. These son of a bitches. I mean, here is this guy. You ready for this? He wants to cut Social Security, and he has a $78 million nest egg, a pension fund, which would provide a check every month of $428,000. I mean, if he made that for a year, that would put him in the 1%. He gets that a month, and he wants to cut our Social Security. I mean, is there any Republican? I mean, I could take it from a Democrat, but I know no Democrat would do that. Only a Republican would support not only taxing this guy really heavily, but also confiscating some of this wealth, just putting it back into the general treasury where it should have gone. Let's see if that's it for it. Well, I just don't even know what to say about that. Maybe you've got some ideas about it. I wanted to look at a couple of other things, but it seems to have disappeared here in the council. I don't know what happened. You know, they're talking about all these cuts, and one of the things that they're talking about cutting is money for AIDS research. Yeah, who cares about them? You know, it's just poor and gays and what have you, right? So, Republicans are all about doing well. A group of nude protesters, that's always a great way to get attention, right? A group of nude protesters stormed into House Majority Leader's Republican Representative John Boehner office on Capitol Hill Tuesday afternoon. Now, you remember, he pronounces his name Boehner, so people don't call him Boehner. But we know, because the harmonica, the German harmonica maker, the famous harmonica, is Hohner, spelled the same way except with an H. And when two vowels go walking, the first one does the talking. Now, I'm reading this, so I don't know how this came down, but seven demonstrators from the group ACT UP came into the office of the House Speaker. We said that, didn't it? Oh, I said it twice here. House Speaker Boehner in the Longworth House office building around 12:30. ACT UP is devoted to backing legislation to fund additional research to end the AIDS crisis. The protesters were upset about budget cuts to federal funding in the fight against AIDS and chanted. Now, no one calls him Boehner except for me, right? And maybe people of German ancestry that know how to pronounce German. Of course, they would call me Verba, wouldn't they? Peter Verba, bitte. But so they let's go with the way the commonly accepted name, the way he called. I mean, maybe we should just call people by what they want to be called. So they were saying, Boehner, don't be a dick. Budget cuts will make us sick. So you think that's what they're calling him? Or could they be saying, Boehner, don't be a dick. Budget cuts will make us sick. I don't know. U.S. Capitol Police were called and arrested three of the women, charging them with indecent exposure. And Boehner's office is not commenting on the incident. Yeah, they threw blankets over because you can't let all that stuff be shown. I want my story on, it's here somewhere. But, yeah, here it is. Yeah, some comments from you, too. 313-298-WRIF. So where's all the money going? This kind of creeps me out that none of you that, I know everybody, or does everybody agree? Let's see a show of hands. See, it's not everybody. But I just think this is more a sort of a gut response than anything based on logic or reasoning. Like I say, is there anybody there that wants to defend the tax cuts for the wealthy? Now it says, what was that figure? 60-something% of Republicans do not support a raise in taxes. 59% of Republicans oppose higher taxes on the wealthy. And yet, no one's willing to call and say, yes, I think the wealthy ought to continue to get these tax cuts. And here's my reason. Here's my reason, but I don't hear it. 313-298-WRIF. The climate change thing as well. But, I was saying, is there anyone that can give me a good reason why we shouldn't do drastic cuts to the military budget? Let's start off with a half. I think we could easily go two thirds. We're in no way harming our security, the security of the United States. It might mean we can't fight wars all over the world, but is that a minus or a plus, right? I mean, we can't have bases all over the world, but is that a minus or a plus? But, you know, there is an aspect of what I've talked about before, what's called Keynesian economics, and this is military Keynesianism. Wealth transfer in the form of taxes, they take the money from us, and then the government spends it. And it spends it, it buys stuff. It creates jobs. It says, okay, build us some jets, and then, you know, Lockheed and Boeing, all the rest of them, they build jets so people are employed. But as I've said so many times before, is the military-industrial complex has enormous amounts of waste, so it just, you know, gets taken without really creating any jobs. And also, it's capital-intensive, not labor-intensive, as opposed to if you used all that money for, you know, creating, you know, fixing our infrastructure and saying, okay, we've got an education problem now. Just heard that they're going to start sending kids to school 300 hours more a year. So that'll be cool. Let's do that in Michigan, where what's this upward figure now? I can't even remember. Wouldn't they say they're going to allow, like, am I making this up, like 60 kids in a class? I mean, this isn't college, folks, you know, where you have a big lecture room. You can have 150 people. Even that's a little weird. But certainly with kids, when they're just at this learning point, maybe 15. So why aren't we taking this $1 trillion? And one of the things we're doing is building, and rather than closing them, that's happening in cities around here, building new ones, outfitting them in the best imaginable way, hiring more teachers, and say the most we're going to let our most precious treasure, our kids, assemble in a classroom is 15. And if someone says, hey, we got to have 22, which would be low in most schools these days, we'd say, well, something is wrong in the school district. We got to get them more money. And you say, more money? You're taking more of my taxes? Well, they're taking it already. And your taxes, are, as we said, are lower than they were in 1980, except they're giving it away to the military-industrial complex and the prison-industrial complex. Get rid of those two bad boys, and we'd be in good shape. So here, anybody object to cutting the military budget by two-thirds and do what with it? How about, well, we said, building the infrastructure, free college tuition. Why should our young people be saddled with this incredible debt? Build more colleges, send more kids to school. How about this one? The Marine version of the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, already more than a decade in the making, is facing a crucial question. Could the jet, which can soar well past the speed of sound, land at sea like a helicopter? This is not quite a sentence. Could the jet, which can... Well, where was their editor? Could the jet, which can soar well past the speed of sound, land at sea like a helicopter? That's a question. On an October day last year, with Lieutenant Colonel Fred Schenck at the controls, the plane glided towards a ship off the Atlantic coast, and then its engine rotating straight down descended gently to the deck at 7 feet a second. Wow, it works! The smooth landing helped save the model and breathe new life into the huge F-35 program, the most expensive weapons system in military history. But while Pentagon officials now say the program is making progress, it begins its 12th year in development, years behind schedule, troubled with technological flaws, and facing concerns about its relatively short flight range as possible threats grow from Asia. All right, you know, the new phrase, even all the academics use this now. Let's unpack that sentence. I hate the phrase. Let's just look at it. So it's got all this problem, let's see, with a record price tag, potentially in the hundreds of billions of dollars. Can you believe that? The jets would cost taxpayers almost $400 billion, right? That's almost half a trillion, including research and development, if the Pentagon sticks to its plan to build almost 2,500 of these by the late 2030s. That would be nearly four times as much as any other weapons system and two-thirds of the $589 billion the United States has spent on the war in Afghanistan. Oh, that really accomplished a lot as well, right? All we needed were some Navy SEALs to take care of what we saw was the worst problem there. So, we've got this half-trillion-dollar airplane because, and it has problems, about it has a relatively short flight range as possible threats grow in Asia. Anybody want to tell me about the possible threats to the United States growing in Asia? Anybody? 313-298-WRIF. What about those Chinese, you know? Well, couldn't be the Japanese, couldn't be the Indochinese, couldn't be the Malaysians or the Indonesians. So that leaves China. It's a big country, and how's their military stack up to us? Well, it doesn't whatsoever. Want to make sure. Can't let those Chinese start, getting above us in military prowess. Didn't they just, field if you've got an aircraft carrier? Launch an aircraft carrier, some rebuilt thing or something like that, and they're flying some jets off it. It's ridiculous. United States has more military capacity and spends more than, what's the figure? Something like 10 times more than anybody else or more than the top 10 other countries combined. And it's kind of these kind of expenditures that that sunk the Roman Empire, that gutted the British Empire and all that. I mean, it's just money wasted. And why doesn't anybody ever think of this? No one ever even talks about this. Why don't we make a peace treaty with China, or what you would say, a non-aggression treaty, and say, you know what, we're not going to put together this F-35 because the only thing we could use it for would be a war against China. What about Russia? Well, how about that? How about if we had a big peace treaty, a big confab where we got all the major powers together and we said some unusual things? So many people in the world starving, environmental problems, so many ethnic conflicts in different areas around the world. And we have all these nuclear weapons that nobody ever wants to use, but countries like France and Israel. And why do these countries have nuclear weapons? I mean, particularly, you might even make it, Israel, that's their final card. But why does France have nuclear weapons? Well, what are the other? Missing a couple here. Britain, France. A couple other places, don't they? China, yeah. So we'll say, and we'll go through this nuclear disarmament. You say, you can't trust the Rusky. Oh, no, that was the Soviet Union. Can you trust the Russians now? Well, there are ways, particularly with modern technology and surveillance and all, you can find out what's going on in countries much better than you ever could. And would you have the kind of thing like after the Nazi-Soviet pact in the late 1930s, suddenly the Nazis turned on their erstwhile non-aggression pact partner, the Soviet Union? Well, maybe, but the United States would still be the most powerful military country in the world. But no, it's not even a thought of that. I mean, why isn't there a thought of, for instance, offering to Iran to make a non-aggression treaty with stipulations? And it doesn't matter. I mean, if you're the big dog, like the United States is, and you can make all sorts of offers, and so what if somebody says, up yours? So what? You go, okay, we tried. I mean, I don't understand that. I mean, everybody has a vested interest in not having a war. But there's fears, of course, of aggression. And always, most, like China, is always concerned about the United States because they're not messing around here. They don't have any fleets, Chinese fleets, over by our borders the way we have around, their shores. We don't have, they don't have, can you imagine that if we have like an Africa command and a South America command? Can you imagine if China had a North American command? Think about that. Think about what we would think about if all of a sudden they said they were going to have battle strike groups, kind of going through the Panama Canal or something like that. Let's see, nuclear arms list. China has 240 warheads. France has under 300. Russia has 1,500. The UK has 225, and the US has 5,113. So the United States doesn't have more than everybody combined, but close to it. Majority of them up by. Now wait a minute. No, what am I saying? No, that's right. The United States has more nuclear warheads than China, France, Russia, UK, and Israel. You don't have that in there because they don't admit to it, although everybody knows that they do have them. So what would be what's the downside of approaching countries that we're talking about as possible threats grow from Asia? And what's the possible threat over there? And what would China want? You know, in the age of imperialism and colonialism, the United States cooperated with the European powers to exploit places like China and South Asia and all that. That's why there's all those anti-colonial wars going back then. That's why World War II was fought essentially for control of China. Japan wanted to have this, what was it, co-prosperity sphere, I think it was. And they wanted to control the whole Pacific Rim. They had their eyes on California and Vancouver even. But mainly they wanted China as a way to exploit the population for labor and for the raw materials and what have you. China has its sights set on, I don't know. What do they have their sights set on? Some of these little islands or something like that. They want to dominate probably the world economy. And so they can do that without firing a shot. And they can also do that without making a big military. Because the more we spend on military, the less we have for schools and infrastructure and all that. It was just a spiraling down. Let's see. It's even, oh yeah, North Korea. Thank you, John. Probably has them as well. North Korea. Again, they're going to start testing these long range missiles and what have you. So, cut the military budget by a third, I would say. And by the way, remember I was giving that figure just a minute ago that these F-35s would cost us almost $400 billion as possible threats from Asia grow. Now, how do they get all this money out of the legislators? Right? Well, one of the things they do, they put these facilities all over the country so every congressman has a vested interest in continuing the military-industrial complex. So it's this corrupt racket. I mean, the whole country turns out to be this corrupt racket. I don't mean you. I don't mean, you know, where you work. I don't mean the business that you run and all that. But the motor of this country is corrupt. The financial industry and a lot of the productive mechanism as well. Corrupt in the I guess I would say ethically and morally corrupt in the terms that they ruin the economies of cities like Detroit and other so-called Rust Belt areas by figuring, hey, we want to pay people a little bit of money, so we're going to take the jobs out of the communities here in the United States and we'll get filthy rich on paying people 14 cents an hour in Bangladesh. But anyway, the Pentagon contractors spent almost $50 million lobbying Congress during the first 9 months of 2012. Are you ready for this? The people that want to continue to loot the public treasury of the money that you and I and our families have put in there and that are talking about the need to cut Social Security, the need to cut Medicare, to cut AIDS research and a whole bunch of other stuff with schools and the like. They spent $50 million lobbying. Lobbying! You know, what does that mean? I mean, they hired lobbies, they took people out to dinner, they flew around on their little jets and all that. Wow. It's just absolutely amazing. In the meantime, back in the United States, another article in the Times, financial worries pile on long before graduation. Where's the free college education movement? Now, we've talked about that before. This article says money troubles interfere with the academic performance of about one-third of all college students, and a similar number of students regularly skip buying required academic materials because of the costs, according to a recent survey. I mean, you just can't believe what these books cost. And then, of course, they change them. So when you try, you just spent $80 for a book, and you go, well, now I'll sell it back, and maybe I'll get 60. No, they say, sorry, it's out of date. We'll give you $3.50. And next quarter, you got to buy another expensive one. in an era of stagnant incomes, and all of this needs parentheses, should say stagnant incomes from ordinary people, from middle class and working class people, and rising tuition and student debt, the burden of college costs on families and former students is well documented. But the new findings from the National Survey of Student Engagement show that financial worries are a major source of stress for undergraduates while they are still in school. Actually, I went to college for a long time. I just never graduated. But, I mean, my dad was paying for it, and it was cheap. It was real cheap. And I never had to work. Most of the people I know, a few people worked when I went to Michigan State, then when I went to Wayne State here in Detroit. And a few people here worked, but it was no big thing. Now, what a burden on families. About three-fifths of students surveyed reported they often worry about having enough money to cover ordinary costs, and students who spend the most hours at paying jobs are not surprisingly those feeling the most financial stress. Among those who work more than 20 hours a week, about three-fifths said that the jobs got in their way of schoolwork. What's more important? 700 overseas bases giving billions of dollars to these dictatorships around the world, or getting the stress off our kids that are going to be the next generation that has an education that's worth its name. I mean, isn't there somebody out there that's going to say, I don't want free education. I want this all to go to the military? Probably not the way I have posed it. Okay, I want to take a break, and I want to come back, and I want to find these articles that I've been looking for that have to do with exactly that. I mean, what we're paying for and what we're paid. Right back with that.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Detroit's Rock Station on the web. Thanks for listening to WRIF.com. Thanks for listening to 101 WRIF on the World Wide Web at WRIF.com.
I'm through with standing in line. The clubs I'll never get in. It's like the bottom of the ninth, and I'm never gonna win this. Life hasn't turned out quite the way I want it to be.
Tell me what you want.
I want a brand new house on an episode of Cribs, and a bathroom I can play baseball in, and a king size tub big enough for 10 plus me.
I'm what you need.
I'll need a credit card that's got no limit, and a big black jet with a bedroom in it. Gonna join the Mile High Club at 37,000 feet.
Done.
I want a new tour bus full of old guitars. Find a star on Hollywood Boulevard. Somewhere between Cher and James Dean is fine for me.
So how you gonna do it?
I'm gonna trade this life for fortune and fame. Cut my hair and change my name, 'cause we all just wanna be big rock stars and live in hilltop boxes driving 15 cars. The girls come easy and the drugs come cheap. We'll all stay skinny 'cause we just won't eat, and we'll hang out in the coolest bars and the VIP with the movie stars. Every good gold digger's gonna wind up there. Every playboy bunny with a bleach blonde hair. Hire 8 bodyguards that love to beat up vessels. Find a couple autographs so I can eat my meals for free. I'm gonna dress my ass with the latest fashion. Get a front door key to the Playboy Mansion. Gonna date a centerfold that loves to blow my money for me.
So how you gonna do it?
I'm gonna trade this life for fortune and fame. I'd even cut my hair and change my name. 'Cause we all just wanna be big rock stars and live in hilltop houses driving 15 cars. The girls come easy and the drugs come cheap. Well, I'll stay skinny 'cause we just won't eat, and we'll hang out in the coolest bars and the VIP with the movie.
stay skinny cause we just won't eat.
Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. This is our final segment. I'm talking in the plural because Julene Jordan is always here with me. She's not here tonight, and both she and I will be off next week. And let's see. Actually, I've been saying over a few times that at 1 a.m., which is just in 26 minutes, that I'm going to be interviewing a tape. Wow, man, is that 20th century or what? A digital recording. Eugene Jarecki, who is the director, writer, and author of this film on the failing drug war, The House I Live In. $1 trillion spent, 45 million people arrested, drugs still more plentiful and more available than ever. And you think, okay, I know that. I've heard that 100 times. This documentary and the interview with Jarecki is pretty incredible. And The House I Live In is at the main theater in Royal Oak starting this coming Friday, December 7th. Also, Liza Featherstone, she's a labor journalist. And she describes Black Friday. Remember, it sounds like whew, so long ago when, you know, the day after Thanksgiving. And she's talking about the scene at Walmart where workers organized protests, and protested wages and benefit conditions at this giant retail chain. You can go to my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com. And there's some great stuff on there. And let's see. One of them is anonymous, you know, those people that do all this online stuff, like they hack sites of you know, banks and all that have been involved in stuff they disagree with. Well, according to a lot of theory, it's possible that Anonymous saved the election from Republican strategist Karl Rove. Many of you may remember he was on Fox News when Fox News called the election for Barack Obama by calling the election by calling Obama the winner in Ohio. And Rove went apoplectic, saying, oh, there's more coming in. Well, without going through the whole thing, is that there is a link on my site, Peter Werby, WERBE.com, where Tom Hartman, one of our colleagues, talks about how the election in 2004 was stolen, and this one was planned to be stolen as well in the same method on the same time. But Anonymous saved the day. Also, Stevie Wonder canceled a concert for the Friends of the Israel Defense Force. This is an odd little deal. Stevie Wonder called off his concert that raises money for the Israeli military. This is a group in the United States. I mean, we're giving them billions of dollars of tax money. But he'd been scheduled to perform December 6th for the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces. And he said that the United Nations recommended canceling his performance because he is, quote, an official messenger of peace for the organization. The United Nations overwhelmingly voted to recognize a Palestinian state on Thursday over vehement U.S. and Israeli objections as hopes, as they say, for Mideast peace stall. And Stevie Wonder said in a statement he was canceling with a heavy heart, but that I am and have always been against any war, anytime, anywhere. There were a lot of petitions online to cancel the performance, which is kind of strange. I mean, you know, we were saying before, I keep saying we, like Jalene is here, she's not, that I was saying before about it would be, you know, kind of similar to the China having a North American military command. The same thing. I mean, who else has groups in this country raising money for foreign military? Don't they have to register under the Foreign Foreign Agents Registration Act? Maybe they do. The United States, I guess, was the I think it was just the United States and Israel that voted against recognizing the Palestinians in the United Nations. But Israel returns the favor, and this was a couple of weeks ago. The UN General Assembly on November 13th voted overwhelmingly to condemn the U.S. commercial, economic, and financial embargo against Cuba for the 21st year in a row. The final tally was 188 nations condemning the United States for its embargo and three supporting us. So the United States supported our own selves, then Israel, and then Palau. Huh? Palau, P-A-L-A-U. I think they're worried. I think this is one of these island nations that's going to be washed away when it comes down to it. All right, so let's take some calls. We got a little bit of time. Here is Tim. Tim's in Romeo. Go ahead, Tim. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. First time, long time, man.
Okay, great.
Hey, I wanted to comment on that Walmart thing you were just talking about.
Sure.
When the old man started the business, didn't he take care of his employees real good? You know, paid them well, gave them good benefits?
You know what? That's an interesting question, Tim. I have to plead ignorance on that one. I don't know. I mean, they certainly are now in major class war to keep the poor poor, that's for sure.
Yeah, you know, and then the kids took over. And like you said last week, it's what, $1.6 billion, the four of them?
No, God no! They wouldn't even be in the top ten. Between the four or five of them, I'll have to dig this out. They have $107 billion in worth.
Yeah, and they can't take care of their employees. You know, pay them a good fair wage plus give them benefits. You know, that to me tells that you know the old man didn't teach his family well very well.
They're heartless. You know? They're absolutely heartless. They pay people $7.75 an hour. $8 an hour. You know what that comes out to? $16,000 a year for full time. And a lot of them, what they try to do, they try to make them not work full time. So, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Keep them under 30 hours and you don't have to pay them benefits, which you know what? They're an employee, period, so they should have to pay them benefits, period. No matter if they work 10 hours or if they work 30 hours.
You know, I don't know if you were listening earlier to give you an idea how much people make. There's this lawsuit against Al Taubman for sexual harassment, and the attorney said he was going to just ask for damages in 1%, for 1% of Al Taubman's net worth, which is $2.9 billion. And that's nothing. Remember, this is the Waltons have $107 billion. And poor Al only has $2.9 billion. So I said, if you took $29 million from Al Taubman, I said, I can't do the math what he would wind up with. And Bart writes in, I like this. He said $2.9 billion minus $29 million is effectively $2.9 billion when you round it off.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So these guys got so much money, and they could do so much good, because figure this. Say that there's, and I always forget whether there's four or five of them. Let's say there's four. If all of their money, except for $4 billion, so they would have $103 billion would go away. And it would go, into their employees or wherever in, taxes and all that. That would actually be a private stimulus. That would be $100 billion stimulus to the economy, giving people at the lowest rung of the working class that are, they work their butts off and they still wind up in poverty. And those people would go out and spend so much, they'd probably even come back and buy a lot of it at Walmart. So the kind of unconscionable greed that these Waltons have, and they're the kind of mean too. You know, they just close stores if they try to do it. So yeah, all right, okay. Thank you very much. Here is you get an idea about Walmart, that there was this garment worker fire, these deaths of these garment workers in Bangladesh. 110 people died in this fire in this factory. And here is what this is from Kalpona Akhtar says. She is with the Bangladesh Center for Worker Solidarity. And as late as Monday, Walmart was claiming it did not have a current relationship with the Dazreen factory in Bangladesh, where the 110 workers were trapped. Only after actor produced a picture of himself holding up clothing with Walmart's exclusive Faded Glory label found at the factory did Walmart admit that the factory was still a supplier, claiming it didn't know that this was the case. Actor started work in a garment factory when she was 12 years old. She said, she now campaigns for better wages, recognition of the right to organize, and higher safety standards.
Wow.
Now, that is why Walmart got out of here, right? Because and the clothing manufacturers, because they didn't want to have to produce, they didn't want to have to create those kind of working conditions that our last caller talked about and that this worker that is mentioning from Bangladesh. She said, I've been a garment worker in Bangladesh and since she was 12 years old, and I know the terrible conditions that workers must face every day. Dangerous safety risks, poverty wages, abusive treatment, unsafe conditions, and unsafe drinking water. Walmart, H&M, Gap, and other major buyers have a responsibility, she says, to workers to clean up their practices and make sure that no more workers have to die to sewing cheap clothing while these brands make millions of dollars in profit. This is Murder Incorporated. Murder Incorporated was something that the pardon me, that the mafia had during the 1930s and 1940s. And they were assassins. They paid for killing. And essentially, that's what's happening here. But so think about your jeans. My wife brought home a pair of jeans, and she said, oh, look, I got these on sale for $45. They were like 66 or something like that. You know, that's just, I don't even know where the hell they were from. Anyway, but so the labor costs go exceedingly downward, right? Labor costs are cut, and this is what the companies want. They want to always, from the beginning of capitalism, they wanted to pay the least possible. The only thing they wanted us as workers to do was to be able to reproduce ourselves so we could come back to work the next day. And they wanted to keep these costs as low as possible. And they fought like hell with our attempt to artificially raise them through unions and legislation. Remember, they didn't want the minimum wage, they didn't want any unions or anything like that. They just wanted to keep working us 12 and 14 hours a day for nothing, like they're doing to people in Bangladesh now. But the labor costs are down, and the product price goes up. I mean, what is going like on like this? So, but there's a little difference here. It's not like early U.S. or British capitalism or anything like that. They were just interested in, you know, the manufacturers themselves. Now you have a buyer, because Walmart is this, you know, major purchaser, and it can dictate the prices it pays for what it buys from these producers in other countries. So it will say, hey, we want to give you, for these jeans that I, what did I say? I can't remember now. $45 to kind of pull that up. It was something like that. $45. We want to give you $6 for those. And this is, well, I don't think we can manufacture them for $6 and make a profit here in Bangladesh. They say, sorry, we'll go to somebody that can. They go, wait a minute. What if we reduce the wages of our workers from 18 cents an hour to 14 cents an hour? And this is not, I'm not manufacturing these wage prices. That's real. And then we can make maybe 75 cents on every pair of jeans we make. And Walmart, this $107 billion family, says, okay, let's do it. All right, let's take another call. We just got a little bit of time left. Here's David in Jackson. Hey, David, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, I just wanted to say that, you know, these people who are making these large amounts of money, you know, just like every American, I'm sure that they're putting their money back into their community through their church or whatnot. You know, the community-based organizations like the Lions Club or whatever that they belong to. You know, so, I mean, it's unfair to say, you know, that they shouldn't have this money because obviously they knew how to earn it.
Well, they didn't know how to earn it. The Waltons never earned it ever. They inherited it. And by paying people less and less wages, they made more and more money. And do they do charitable I'm sure a little, but it's not like it ever cuts into it. They just seem to be worth billions and billions of dollars more. And the less they can pay their employees, the more money they have. And for some reason or other, they're not satisfied. I mean, can you imagine David having $1 million? I can't.
I own property, you know, and, you know, people think I have money because I own property, but, you know, it's not, you know, I don't, it doesn't generate, you know, wealth for me.
I know. But so you don't have $1 million, do you?
No.
No, $1 million is nothing to these people. Like we said, that if you took $2.9 million from a guy like Al Taubman that has $2.9 billion, he would still have $2.9 billion. I mean, it wouldn't even affect him. And this money is lodged there. I mean, don't you think that people ought to be, for, you know, I don't know, and sometimes small businessmen like yourself, they have trouble making, you know, wages is a big part of cost of small businesses. But if you have $107 billion, do you think you should be fighting against workers trying to make a living wage?
I think that it's their right in America to pay them whatever they're going to pay them.
Well, you are correct, but what about an ethical look at it? What about the fact that this kindergarten thing is about don't bring candy to school unless you can share with everyone? I mean, why would you defend a greed that makes life so miserable for hundreds and hundreds of thousands of their workers while they're so enriched that they can open up museums with hundreds of millions of dollars of art objects and still be worth billions?
You know, if you can get that much money, if you can amass that much wealth, then you're entitled to it.
Well, you know, you are or you aren't. As things are now, you're legally entitled to it. You could, you know, at other points, like during the Eisenhower years, the 1950s, the marginal, highest marginal tax rate was 91%. I forget what it was. After you made after $6 million, the tax rate on your money was like 91%. So it was almost confiscatory taxes. And things were awful during the 50s and economically, weren't they? Oh, no. They were pretty good. In fact, the higher the tax rates, if you go back in American history, the higher the tax rates, the better the economy. Because these multi-billionaires that you seem to have a soft spot for, I mean, sure, maybe they give a little bit in charity, but, I mean, when you have a mayor of New York that's worth $10 billion and wants you and me to bail out the residents of his city for exactly that amount, I mean, why doesn't he pony up about $8 billion of his own money, and then he would wind up with $2 million, or $2 billion only, $2 billion. I mean, you and I, if we had $2 million, we'd be wealthy beyond our dreams imaginable. And you say that it's their right. Well, yeah. I mean, legally, I guess it's their right. I mean, they amass this immense fortune, which they do not put back into the community. I mean, they might, you know, give a few mil here and there. I mean, the Koch brothers, they do a lot of charity. In the meantime, they're doing everything they can to destroy the, you know, the wage structures that unions have built up over the years. Let me get a few more calls. Thanks for calling in. Here's Gary. Gary is in Kenoke, is it? Are you? Oh, I'm sorry, Gary. I didn't press the right button. Sorry, Gary. Here we are. Is it Kenoke?
Kenoke, Michigan.
Where is that?
That's near Port Huron.
Oh, you know what? Whenever anybody says a city where I don't know where it is, they always say it's near Port Huron. Anyways, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh.
Dude, you're on the air. Turn your radio off and
all right.
Okay.
All right, yeah. I'm going to turn it up.
Okay. No, not up, off.
Yeah.
All right, go ahead.
All right. Well, you know, my parents make a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, and they did it on their own. I mean, they went through a hard time. They owned a business.
Yeah.
Well, first off, my dad worked down in Port Huron for 25 years and raised us kids. Did a damn good job at it. And then he left there and he bought a business, built that business up, sold it, and they bought properties and things like that. And I mean, they made darn good living. You know, and I mean, I'm thinking that they're probably upwards of $250
mm-hmm.
a year. And I just don't really think that, you know, I mean, they don't owe me none. I work. I'm a disabled veteran.
Yeah.
I was in the military. I got hurt in the first war.
Yeah.
Desert Storm. So
okay.
I fought for the first Bush, you know, and didn't really understand why. I mean, I ain't going to lie. I lost my best buddy over there, too.
Yeah, a lot of people do.
I mean, things ain't necessarily good, but I mean, just because people make, you know, upwards of 200 or some thousand dollars doesn't mean that they owe me anything.
Well, you know, it depends on how you look at it. For one thing, I mean, if you make $200,000, $250,000, you're not rich. And for one, the tax increase that would go back into effect that had been, you know, if it goes back to the tax level it was, people that are making $200,000 or $250,000, I forgot what the increase is. It isn't real great. It starts really climbing when you get into the billions. And that's an interesting phrase, though, you say about owing you. I mean, what do we owe anybody? I mean, you figure you owe your family, I mean, or you owe your friends, and we take care of one another. You know, if people came to you and needed some help, needed a shoulder to cry on or something like that, I'm sure you'd be there for them. And if you had it and they needed a, you know, few bucks loan, you'd probably give it to them like most would, because most of us are kind and open-hearted. But when we start talking about people in the broader community, suddenly people get a little harder about that, and they start, like David before us, starts defending people that are these multi-billionaires that are billionaires at the expense of ordinary working people who are our neighbors. I don't get it.
Well, here, I got another little bit of a scenario for you. Actually, my wife works for Sam's.
Okay.
So, and she's been there for 13 years.
And if I may ask, I could probably guess, what does she make? She'd be lucky if she makes $12 an hour.
No, actually, she's she makes $14.95 an hour.
Well, okay, she is up there at the top of the scale. That's $30,000.
Yeah, I mean, you know, she's not, you know, she's not doing that bad. But, you know, there again, I mean, they don't get, you know, everybody's like, when they hear that she works at Sam's, they're like, oh, well, do you get discounts and all that? No. She don't get nothing. She has to pay for her own health insurance. She has to pay for all this stuff. The only thing she gets is the same exact membership that everybody gets for free.
She can shop there. Well, what I was saying earlier, Gary, if they would part with their money, imagine that, if they let loose of $103 billion of the family's wealth, and these kids didn't earn it, just got given to them by Sam, that they could push that out into the community in the form of increased wages. If someone's been there that long, they should be making way more than $30,000. They should have a paid-for pension. They should, you know, fixed benefit pension. They should be having full health care and all of that. And if we took, I forgot the figures now, what I was saying, $103 billion from them, they'd be left with a measly $1 billion a year. And you know what? Nobody can spend that much money. It's impossible. Listen, I got to go. I am at the end of my show. I want to thank you for being the last caller. It sounds like you've had some experiences in life for sure. But thank you for joining us. I appreciate it. If you're on hold, my apologies. We got to go. Got this interview for this absolutely must-see film. It's about the drug war. Be explaining it right off the top after these. Let's wish Jalene and her dog all the best and good health. And, hey, neither of us are going to be here next week, but we'll do it again in a couple weeks.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this. This is 101 WRIF. Thanks for rocking with us online at WRIF.com.
How would you like to see customers through your door today and the next day and the day after that? I have the answer you're looking for. RiffDeals.com. Hey, you're online now. Just click on the banner in the player window to find out more. Remember, there's no upfront cost to you. It's a partnership with your success as the goal. WRAF's marketing pros work with you to develop the perfect deal. Then RiffDeals.com uses the power of on-air, online, and social media marketing to help you reach new customers. Oh, did I mention that you get a check within 10 days of your successful deal running? That's cash in your pocket and customers in the door.
Detroit's rock station rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
The 12 days of Riffmas are back. Keep listening for your next chance to win. Details online at WRIF.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, we've talked a lot about the drug war, how much it's cost, how much human wreckage as a result of it. And when you think maybe we know enough about it. Something comes along, in this case a documentary film that just knocked me off my feet. It's going to start here in the Detroit area this coming Friday, December 7th, at the main theater in Royal Oak. And it's a film done by Eugene Jarecki. He's got quite a history behind him of incredible documentaries like Why We Fight. That was up on my website, peterwerby.com, for a long time, a link to it. He also did The Trials of Henry Kissinger, and he's a guest very frequently on media around everything from The Daily Show to Fox News, The Colbert Report, the BBC, and in fact, I think we could take up an enormous amount of time talking about all of those credits. The brand new film about the drug war is The House I Live In. Its writer and director and producer is Eugene Jarecki. A privilege to have you on. Welcome to the broadcast.
Glad to be here.
Now, you know, I never get to read the books before I interview authors, and I thought, you know, I know enough about the drug war, and I saw you on Bill Maher, and I don't have to watch this. And, you know, I did, and I watched it through the credits, through to the last credit. It's an absolutely astounding documentary, and it answered, the credits answered the first question I was going to ask you, which, if it's a film about the drug war, where does the title, The House I Live In, come from, which is answered in the credits?
Well, in one way, you know, of course, I'm looking at the whole country. I traveled to about 25 states to learn more about what the drug war had done to particularly poor populations in America, African-American and minority communities. And all of that has a lot of resonance for me as a house we all live in, as a problem we all are experiencing, whether we are directly touched by the drug war or not. It's coming to a theater near you, as it were, because it's spreading and because it has targeted, you know, Eugene Debs once famously said that while there was a soul in prison, he was not free. And I feel that about America. I feel that as goes the least of us, of my brothers, so go I. And so that title, when I heard it on a song that Paul Robeson and Frank Sinatra had both done different versions of in the 1930s and 40s, and it's a very beautiful song that does play over the closing credits, and it's a song about their hopes for a very open, very fair, very equal, very multicultural America. It says, you know, what is America to me? And it really asks, what is it all about here? What is this country about, and what's great and good about it? And all those things that are great and good about the America in that song are things that I see under siege in today's America of exploitation and of corruption and of corporate power mingling with government power at the expense of people. And that's ultimately what our system of mass incarceration looks like to me. And so it's a very different portrait of America that, of course, makes me quite sad and quite motivated to seek reform.
Well, Eugene Jarecki, you use the word sad. I watched it last night up till about midnight, and I came to bed, and my very sensitive wife said, "Have you been crying?" I went, "No," you know, and I had been. Your documentary, The House I Live In, actually brought tears to my eyes on several occasions as I went to sleep in this warm, suburban, middle-class house and realized what other people are suffering as a result of the drug war. And this is not just an objective look at it, but also this is a very personal film as well, and that was some of the saddest points in it. I wonder if you could maybe explain that just a little bit.
Sure. Well, the way a comfortable, white, pudgy, suburban guy like me, you know, I came out of being a suburban kid growing up in just outside New York City, and I was not going to be one of those people whose life was going to be heavily damaged by the drug war. It only happened to me through people I cared about and knew, particularly in the African-American community that I was growing up very close to, and I watched families, African-American families, in the wake of the civil rights movement, which is when I'm a kid in the 70s, I'm watching that the promises of the civil rights movement are somehow not bearing fruit. They're not coming to pass for the masses of people. I mean, sure, we have a black American president, and we have certain black celebrities in America that make a huge contribution, but for the masses of black people, anyone who looks at the facts and the hard data will just know very clearly, and also from personal experience, that for the masses of black people, the leading indicators, political, economic, and social, are all very grim and have been for a long time. The number of black men incarcerated versus the number who go to college, for example, you know, how many out of three black men will, you know, ultimately see prison in their lifetime. We've heard these statistics all the time growing up, but it was having a very real impact on people I knew, and in particular one woman who I had grown up around, who had worked with my family, and I cared very strongly about her, and I've known her my whole life, and she's a very dear friend to me in this day and age as well. And I had seen that she was really reporting that she was the first generation of Black Americans that was truly, better off than their children. It was the first time where that had shifted in some way.
Well, I was going to say, rather, I would, that's key to it. That's key to the film, The House I Live In, your relationship with this woman and her reaction to your family and to her family, because she essentially loses her son to the drug war.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so by that happening, you know, in my watching, her name is Nanny Cheddar. She's not a nanny. It's just her birth name was Nanny. By watching Nanny experience what she experienced of the drug war in such a personal way. And by the way, her son is only one person in her family touched by the drug war of many. I mean, she has many, many people in the generation after her whose lives were really torn apart by not the drugs. I mean, sure, those have their damage, and nobody's in any debate about the damaging nature of drug addiction to human beings. In fact, I'm the largest proponent possible of the need to see this as a personal problem that needs major help of a compassionate kind. But instead, what she saw was the drug war, which is the business end of the drug war, of the drug issue, because what happens there is, in fact, people make a business out of treating you like a criminal instead of like a victim when you're addicted. And so what we've seen in America since 1971, which is when the drug war was declared, and again, that's kind of my lifespan, you know, what we've seen is over 40 years we've watched the prison population in America explode 700%, so that we now have 2.3 million people behind bars, more than any other country on earth. We've spent $1 trillion on the drug war. We've had 45 million drug arrests. And what do we have to show for it? Drugs are cheaper, purer, more available than ever before, and used by younger and younger people. So this record of abject failure that has only turned this beacon of democracy basically into a gulag nation in the eyes of our democratic partners in the world, all of that came at tremendous personal direct cost to Mrs. Jeter's family, both in the person of her son and others. And it was really that window that, you know, I wondered if this is what was happening to her family, how much was she the rule or how much was she the exception? And she was the rule. I mean, it's a widespread phenomenon in both the African-American community and now more broadly just in poor communities vulnerable to disproportionate law enforcement profiling, then ultimately the biases that exist in the courts because judges don't have the power to sentence people with full information. They have to sentence people according to guidelines that have been devised by Congress people seeking votes who want to look like they're tough on crime, so everything tilts toward incarceration. And then you get into the prison system itself, which is meant to correct people, but it has its budgets robbed by the very same tough-on-crime politicians who, you know, fear-monger in the streets in order to get elected. They end up having to make promises like they'll have, you know, more handcuffs, more cops, more this, more that, more overtime hours for police, and all those draconian measures, and those cost money. And so where does that money come from? It comes right out of the prison system's ability to have programs that can, you know, get people back on their feet.
Yeah.
So you send them more people and give them less that they can do with them, and then we wonder why we're warehousing people as a national phenomenon.
My guest is Eugene Jarecki. He's the director, writer, and producer of The House I Live In. You can go to thehouseilivein.org. It's going to open at the main theater Friday, December 7th. And I would recommend that everyone see it. And I don't usually make those kind of recommendations, but when you start realizing from this film the toll it's taken on our country and in almost every regard, you'll realize that this is a critical film. And hopefully, because the film isn't the most hopeful film, there's a little light at the end of the tunnel, but this could be what could raise the kind of consciousness that give people the space to start making some changes. Am I right? Here we all, you know, marijuana has been legalized and medical marijuana and all that. Is there an opening here?
I do think things are happening, and I think things are happening because after 40 years of such abject failure, this thing is very hard to defend. And what that means is, you know, you have people on all sides of the aisle, from Grover Norquist off on one end all the way to Al Sharpton on the other, who are now agreeing they find common cause in the idea that, on the one hand, this thing is immoral, a wrong-headed way of dealing with the already victimizing impact of drugs. You then make somebody's life worse. I mean, if we had a friend and they came to us and said, hey, I've got an addiction of this kind or that, would the first thing we do be to call the cops?
No.
We would do something that has compassion in it, whether Christian compassion, American compassion, or just human compassion. We would try to figure out how do you show tough love, for example. What we do now is just tough. earlier and how grotesque the numbers are in that. But then, of course, it's not sustainable economically, and so you find that people who don't want to be wasting money in the tens of billions a year on this thing anymore recognize that it's not a business. The prison industrial sector is not a business. A business makes a product or provides a service. What this is just a hole in the ground that we bury people in and throw some taxpayer money into it, and then some people profit off that. That's not a business because you can't sell the misery of a prisoner to a foreign country. You can't, market their misery and their shattered home and their broken community. And so it's much like a casino in a way. This is like wealth redistribution of the worst kind. It's taking from the poor and giving to the rich.
Well, I was going to say, though, it is Keynesian economics at its worst. It takes our tax money, and then it creates this prison industrial complex, and it hires lots of people. In your film, The House I Live In, you show scenes from the American Correctional Association meeting, very grotesque. And
the trade show. Yeah.
A trade show. Everything from restraint chairs to buildings and all that. So it is this government stimulus in a way. So it does have an economic impact on, well, maybe tell us just about those small cities and their interest in having prisons.
Well, this all comes down to the Congress people. I mean, everyday people are remote, are really not the force of evil here. We all live in this society, and some of us have one kind of job, and some of us have another, and frankly, there aren't a lot of jobs, and so a lot of the people I meet in the prison industrial system are in jobs that are just what they could get, and they know that there's something wrong with the way we do this. They know that a business built on the mass incarceration of fellow human beings cannot be good. And so at the end of the day, I met person after person in the system who really, from the inside, are crying out for a serious and meaningful measure of reform. And as such, that's super inspiring because, I wanted to get all across the country. I wanted to talk to people who were cops, judges, wardens, jailers, lawyers, prosecutors, et cetera. And what I found was at every level, I found people, really giving me an inside look at what's wrong with what they do and a great openness in saying, we've got to be able to find a better way to do this. Cops from the patrol, from the sort of front seat of their patrol car would tell me how arresting the same people day in, day out, week in, week out, cannot be working. Then you would talk to somebody who comes from who's in the courts, and they would tell you a judge would sit in his chambers and tell me, my hands are tied here. I don't make the decisions. I don't exercise the discretion that you as a citizen think I have because Congress writes laws, these mandatory minimum sentencing laws, and I have to do what those laws say. But one judge told me that the kid in front of him who was about to get a 20-year sentence for crack cocaine, he told me that that kid, he said, if he came in here today, he's here on 5 grams of crack. He said if he had come in here and I found out yesterday that he had won the Medal of Honor, I couldn't take that into account in his sentencing today. He said if he had pulled up a grandmother out of a burning building yesterday, same. He said, but equally stupid is that if he had come in here with 4.95 grams of crack instead of 5 grams, he wouldn't be getting this sentence today. So how can any of this make sense? So when a judge tells you that from his chambers and a policeman tells you it from his patrol car and the prison staff, everywhere I went, I had incredibly smart people in the prison system tell me these very heartfelt concerns about watching this revolving door of people coming in, getting out, getting back in right away because they've not been provided with the tools to fix their lives that are addicted. When all these people cry out for reform, it's inspiring because it tells the rest of us, that from the inside this thing is starting to crumble and therefore I do think change is on the way. And it also inspires the rest of us from our much more comfortable positions because these people are telling me this in a place where it's perilous to talk about it. It's dangerous for their job to tell me what they're telling me, and yet they have the courage to do it anyway. And that's so incredibly important.
Eugene Jarecki, in your film, The House I Live In, there's repeated scenes of people breaking into homes and, pointing guns at people because these, as we've seen on every television show, these are some dangerous criminals. Often, in fact, they are. And yet, I remember Detroit's John Sinclair once said, they go through all this to stop people from smoking flowers. So we understand that abuse of anything, food to alcohol to cigarettes or to any kind of drug is obviously not good and is not healthy. But all of this to stop people from changing their consciousness or in common parlance, getting high. I mean, it seems when you really get to the absolute root of it, it's nuts. I mean, that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah. I mean, I think, look, at the end of the day, we just took a wrong turn as a country. Once upon a time, this was, we had, you know, we've had drug laws that go back to the 1800s that have been, unfortunately, very often and all too often, they've been sort of thinly veiled laws about racial or social control, masquerading as drug laws. So the first drug laws we saw were in the 1800s, and they punished Chinese immigrants very, very selectively for opium use. When other people all over the country were using opium, we passed laws that made it very, sort of very convenient to harass and search and seize and detain Chinese immigrants. And that was the first time we saw such laws. We then saw it again with Mexicans when we took hemp, which was a revered crop since the dawn of the Republic, and we Mexicanized it to call it marijuana so that we could identify it with Mexicans and specially harass them when they were potentially threatening American jobs. And then the same thing happened with Black Americans and many other groups along the way. And so those were sort of an ad hoc improvised history of racist drug laws. What happened in 1971 was that Richard Nixon declared a war on drugs. And by declaring a war, he unleashed the dogs of war, these kind of profiteering dogs that we saw drive us into Iraq and so many other conflicts, where all of a sudden a huge system of bureaucratic thrust starts feeding upon the enterprise. So it isn't just an improvised racist thing. It took on incredible institutional shape, and that's why we've seen this explosion of the bureaucracy of the prison industrial system in the last 40 years. And what that, of course, does is it just makes it harder to stop. It makes it harder to critique and harder to get a foothold to tone it down. And I still think it's going to fail, and I think it's failing under its own weight at the moment. It's such a huge American involvement, and yet it is not profitable. It is extremely, in many ways, it is dangerous to public safety. When you preoccupy the police with the explosion of nonviolent people that we're putting in jail. Remember, this whole conversation is about the over-incarceration of the nonviolent. None of us are debating whether to incarcerate the violent. The reason we have a prison population of 2.3 million people, that explosion has come from the drug war's massive preoccupation with incarcerating the nonviolent and treating them as if they are violent and giving them sentences that are so long you would think they were violent. In California, up until Election Day, you could go to jail for life on a third strike where the third strike was petty or nonviolent. We changed that 2 weeks ago, and my film was used quite centrally in the campaign to overturn that law with Prop 36, so that now, to go to jail for the rest of your life, you have to commit a violent or serious crime. Well, that makes sense, but it wasn't that way for 30 years, and during those 30 years, there were about 4,000 Californian inmates who are in jail for life for three strikes that were all nonviolent. That's just one state. So all across this country, we have thousands of people who were put in jail, sometimes for life sentences, sometimes for 40, 50, 60 years on drug crimes that are nonviolent. And so that absurdity is, I think, dawning on the American people, and it's for that reason that we're starting to see the possibility for some meaningful change.
You know, right now I have no idea where I could get cocaine or heroin, but I'm willing to bet that within 12 hours I could buy cocaine and within 24 hours I could buy heroin. I'm certain of that. Just, sure. I mean, for one thing, we're in the entertainment business, right?
Sure, you could.
So the drug wars, people say, drugs have lost. The film is The House I Live In. I would urge you to see this film on the big screen. It's opening at the main theater in Royal Oak this coming Friday, December 7th. You can go to thehouseilivein.org. My guest is the writer, director, and producer, Eugene Jarecki. We just have a few minutes left with him.
I'd love to say one thing just from my own heart about
sure.
the movie opening in Detroit. I care a great deal about Detroit, and I think that Detroit is America's underdog at the moment that I think a lot of people are rooting for. And there have been several documentaries this year alongside mine, which I would love to urge people to see. One is Searching for Sugar Man, which really presents such an incredibly loving portrait of Detroit and Detroit's sort of valiant struggle against the forces of evil in this country, the forces of economic evil that hurt poor people and working people. And I think that movie really captures something. It's about Rodriguez, of course, but it's also a movie about Detroit and Detroitness and the sort of Detroit against the world quality that we all admire. And the other movie, of course, is the wonderful Detropia. Both of these movies are putting Detroit where it belongs in the national consciousness. And my movie is about a sort of a 25-state study of this country, and everything that's true in my movie is true of Detroit in spades, because Detroit has been so much the sort of epicenter for so much that went wrong in the way that we put profit before people in this country. And my movie, at the end of the day, is about a system, the prison industrial system, our system of mass incarceration, which is probably the most strident example of how we put profit before people. But we do it in every walk of American life. We've become a kind of nation without pity. that around, and I'm hopeful that it will turn around, having gotten as bad as it's gone.
Well, you have some incredible executive producers for The House I Live In. Danny Glover, John Legend, Brad Pitt, Russell Simmons. How did this all come about?
You know, these are people I've worked with over the years who were very aware that I was making this kind of movie, and so they were, you know, in touch with me as I was going, and I wanted to involve them in the work I was doing along the way, both the creative work and then ultimately the planning for how to reach as many people as possible. Because with a movie like this, you don't just want it to play in art houses to concern people and have it kind of live and die in that small space. You want to get out there into churches and prisons and schools and community centers, and we do a great deal of that. And one of the ways we do that is by giving the film a kind of profile that lets us walk more easily through a lot of those doors. And so that's one of the major functions of having these kind of very visible executive producers bring to you. And then, you know, John Legend has recorded a wonderful song, a cover of The House I Live In, that's coming out in January.
Really?
So people will be able to hear his version of Paul Robeson's song. And Brad Pitt launched the film in L.A. at a public screening there, and Danny Glover has accompanied the film both at Sundance and at many other venues we've been to in San Francisco and around the country in Washington. And so, you know, and Russell Simmons, of course, has a large following and has been fighting this drug war issue forever himself. So there's just a lot of, you know, I don't like to do something and be alone. I like to do something not as a voice in the wilderness, but joining with other people who've been long-distance runners for justice in this, and all of my execs, you know, are and have been.
Yeah, you're certainly in great company there. And just in our final minutes, which I think there's about two left, at the beginning of the show you mentioned the effect of the drug war, essentially a drug war against people of color, and particularly the black community in the United States. And you said anyone that sees the stats and knows the history can't help but understand what's going on. Is this a country without pity? Is there a level of compassion? You look at Mississippi, 90% of white people voted for Reagan. You know, these folks are dirt poor. I mean, I worry that people say, oh, drugs, that's, you know, that's a black thing. We got to worry about these people because they're, you know, they're so, you know, involved in crime, and I don't want them in my neighborhood.
But let's look at it. I'll give you the, you know, here's the problem. People don't really know the numbers, so it's easy to lie to people, and most of your listeners have been lied to for decades about the drug war. I'll give you an example. You think of crack as a black drug, right?
Sure.
We all do. We think crack, we think black. Okay. Well, it turns out the majority of crack users in America are white. I didn't know that. I started making the film. I wouldn't have even imagined that. I didn't think any white people took crack. Well, it turns out that black people are 14% of the country, and lo and behold, they're 14% of the crack users.
Wow.
Well, if they're 14% of the crack users, there aren't that many other types of people left in the country. You find very quickly that white people are more than 50% of the crack users in the United States of America. So then why is it that when you go to a federal courthouse, 90% of those charged with crack offenses are black? 90%.
It's what's targeted, right? And that's,
right? Yeah. It has to do with where are the police doing the looking. You know, I live in a comfortable neighborhood. I can sometimes barely not even find a cop when I need one. Try telling that to an inner-city person, or now increasingly with poor whites getting charged with meth, try telling that to somebody who lives in a trailer park. These people are swimming in cops. So first it starts with where are the police doing their work, where are they dispatched to? That's the first thing. Then it has to do with poor people in inner-city neighborhoods and now also in trailer parks. It's harder for them to do the kind of drug use and work that comfortable people do in private. They don't have as much private space. They're in public housing. They're on the street. They have small apartments. They don't have an easy way of doing it. And so their drug trade ends up being very policeable, and it gets very policed. Well, that's the first bias step. The next bias step is they go to a courthouse where, historically, for example, crack is punished 100 times more severely than powder. I didn't know that either. If you're walking down the street with 5 grams of crack, in order for me to get the same sentence as you, I have to have 500 grams of powder on me.
Jeez.
Mine is a huge crime. 500 grams of powder is a major street value.
Yeah.
5 grams of crack is like buying some packs of gum. It's nothing. So you're going to get the same sentence as me, even though you've committed a fraction of the crime.
You know, we are unfortunately going to have to leave it at that, but fortunately, this incredible film, The House I Live In, is going to start at the main theater in Royal Oak Friday, December 7th. Do not miss it. I mean, if you think you know everything about drugs and the drug war and the waste and damage it's caused, you've seen nothing. This is an absolutely incredibly put together documentary. My guest has been its director, writer, and producer, Eugene Jarecki, and did I say, if I didn't, I'm willing to say it again, thehouseilivein.org. There'll be a link on my site, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Eugene Jarecki, thank you for the work. Thank you for the film. Thanks for being on the broadcast.
Thank you very much.
This is Night Call
on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Rockin' Detroit at 101.1 FM and the rest of the planet online at WRIF.com. Thanks for rocking with the riff online. This is WRIF.com.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Well, Black Friday has come and gone, and they had all other kind of things, Shop Local Saturday and Cyber Monday and all that. But the biggie, of course, is Black Friday. And it's not to be confused when the stock market crashed in 1929. Now it means that's when the stores can go into the black, out of the red, right? And that's when they make all of their money, or they start making a profit. It's very, very important. And all the big retailers were out there. I didn't probably have seen these insane scenes of literally door busting. There, at one Walmart store, the employees caught a shoplifter and wound up killing him inadvertently. There were fights. There were knifings. There were shootings. I mean, I don't know. I never can understand why people go out to those things. But that's not the big issue. The big issue is what's going on with wages and jobs in our lives. The economy with the biggies seems to be doing all right. The Wall Street's doing just fine. But where the problems lie are on Main Street with our neighbors, with getting work that has dignity and respect and decent wages. And the fight for that took such a long time. Probably you could, I don't know, maybe even document it from the 1840s through the 1950s. And certainly by the 1970s, unfortunately, things started going south again. So let's take a look at all of this. Joining me is Liza Featherstone. She is a labor journalist, and she wrote a very interesting article called Walmart Workers Walk Out. It was in The Nation magazine, and you may or may not have heard of this, but on Black Friday, there was going to be a walkout of Walmart workers. Now, this is unheard of because the Walmart folks do not go for strikes or unions. But let's find out more about it as we join Liza Featherstone. She's in her office in New York City. Liza, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
It's good to be with you, Peter.
Yeah. Well, where to start? I mean, I think all of us know that Walmart is the largest employer in the world. So a lot of people say they ought to get a lot of credit for that, hiring so many people.
Sure. I mean, and, you know, I think that most of us are really happy to have a job, and that includes the Walmart workers. I think what Walmart workers have been experiencing, however, is that for many, many years, these jobs have just not been adequate to support families and to even to support themselves, and that Walmart has been an incredibly productive company with incredibly productive workers, making a lot of profits, and not shared that success, shared that productivity with the people doing the work, with the people who are smiling at you and greeting you when you walk in, and you know, helping you find stuff, you know, and weathering the stampede of Black Friday customers. Those people are not sharing in the Walmart success story. Although, of course, as you say, you know, people are happy to have a job, but ultimately, that, you know, that gratitude can only go so far. You know, you you need to have a job, but the job also needs to pay your bills.
I get the feeling we're almost back to the 19th century. I mean, all of this literally, you know, the old, you know, deja vu all over again. I mean, many people thought this had all been settled from in the 1930s through the 1950s, where, you know, the middle class was established by having wage standards and benefits that that created people that didn't have to live a mean life.
That's right. And then what we saw in the 1970s was a kind of a revolt by employers against that order, with them wanting to keep more of the profits for themselves, not share it so much with ordinary people, and, you know, a sense by the employer class that the rest of us had gotten to, in their common phrase, fat and happy. You know, so and that was a phrase that they actually used at the time, you know, that the workers had grown fat and happy. And we've seen ever since then an assault on all the different ways that workers have of getting a piece of that pie, whether it's union organizing, employment regulations, even tools like class action suit. We've just seen employers fighting that on every front. The recent Walmart strikes that we saw, Walmart workers walking out of the job on the busiest shopping day of the year, have been an attempt by workers to do a little fighting back of their own after employers have been fighting back for so many years.
Well, you said that they described workers as being fat and happy. Certainly the, mm-hmm. the second part of it is good. But are now Walmart workers thin and miserable?
I don't think they meant fat
no.
as in obese.
You
I think they meant fat in the positive sense
right.
of enjoying the excess.
Walmart says, and we should say, they don't refer to their workers as workers. They're associates. They don't want that cleavage between as the old industrial workers used to say, the working class and the employing class have nothing in common. They said they were always antagonistic. But Walmart says that, these are our associates, they'll always put forth people that'll say, I love my job. And yeah, give us an idea, though, of what we're talking about when we're talking about Walmart workers. How much do they work, and what do they get paid? We kind of all know it's not very high.
Sure, the numbers on the wages are often disputed back and forth by unions and by Walmart itself, but the wages tend to be, and they vary, of course, by different cities, depending on the cost of living. But they're roughly $8.50 an hour, which is above minimum wage, but not much of a living wage. The even more serious than the low hourly wage, though, for many workers is the very few and unpredictable hours that Walmart really likes to keep its employees' schedules very unpredictable. And in recent years, with the very difficult economy, Walmart has really saved money on its workforce by keeping them as part-time and contingent as possible. And even when full-time work is needed, Walmart will hire several part-time workers rather than one full-time worker in order to save on benefits and also to, save on, having to pay people more for seniority, being there for longer. So we're seeing, Walmart workers are now saying that, they're just struggling to get enough hours to make ends meet, much less, in addition to the low wages, and are having to borrow money from their coworkers to eat lunch or even to put gas in the tank to get to Walmart.
Hmm.
They're just barely able to make enough to get there, literally. So it's really it's really been quite a bad situation for Walmart workers. They've also complained over the years of a health care plan that is very stingy and pays very little of their actual health care costs and is quite expensive, takes quite a chunk out of their wages to pay for it. So, and as a result, and, much has been made of this by other media, but as a result, Walmart workers have often had to rely on public assistance and often been given the forms to apply for public assistance by Walmart, an acknowledgement by Walmart that they're not paying their workers enough to subsist without state help.
Liza Featherstone is my guest. She's a labor journalist and has written an article in the recent Nation magazine called Walmart Workers Walk Out, and we're talking about a fledgling movement within Walmart workers or associates to get, as they say, respect and also a living wage. Liza, some people might say, well, Peter Werby and, hey, Liza Featherstone, what business is it of yours? It's between those workers and Walmart, and if Walmart feels that's what they need to do a business, why be disruptive? Why not, the libertarians would always say they don't have to work there. If they don't like the wages there, they should make a market choice and go elsewhere and work. Yeah, well, I'm laughing too, but go ahead.
I'm not laughing at that. I mean, that's a venerable and well-established point of view, and I'm sure many listeners share it.
Oh, I hope not, but go ahead.
They might, I'm laughing because I always actually wonder why libertarians don't share the freedom, don't support the freedom of workers to join their own organizations and, and lobby for better, bargain for better wages and use their power to do so, given that often that doesn't involve the state at all.
Yeah,
but
well,
that's another issue,
sure.
If an interesting one.
Well, when you have an individual worker pitted up against a company, the company has all the power. A single worker has zero, other than workers have to combine collectively, and that's the only way that we've gotten a middle class like we have today, eroding though it may be. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that some of the libertarians listening, I know there are lots of libertarians in Michigan. I lived in Michigan for a while, and I think some of the libertarians would even be sympathetic to that argument. As to the what business is it of ours, I think that's a terrific question. And what business is it of ours is that Walmart's as the largest private employer in our country, Walmart really exerts a power to set wages and to set business practices through its own practices. It has the effect of driving down wages in local markets and in the retail industry generally. So Walmart's practices are not only between its employees and the company, but actually do have a ripple effect throughout our economy.
So
when Walmart workers are standing up for themselves, they're really also standing up for the rest of us.
Yeah, they're creating, Walmart is, the new normal. In fact, it's going to be a contest. Who is going to create what we consider normal in the next period? In the 1880s, it was normal for workers to work 12, even 14 hours a day, 6 days a week, no benefits, no retirements, no pensions, no protection, no safety standards whatsoever. That was all fought and created by labor unions and then enshrined into law because of the labor ferment during the 1930s. So,
And by the way, Peter, I think it's important. You're right to bring up the 19th century because part of how they turned that around, and in particular companies, in particular workplaces, were able to often reshape that even within the 19th century was that workers were constantly going on strike. I mean, the 19th century was just full of, that was just constantly happening. With the result that if you look at the 19th century, things like layoffs were surprisingly rare, because the workers were so constantly going off strike that when employers did things like that, they knew what was going to happen. So, although the labor conditions were dismal in the 19th century, certainly worker actions were part of the long process of turning that around.
We should tell people, too, if they want to hook up or just get some more information about the Walmart workers, they can go to, it's actually called Our Walmart, Organization United for Respect at Walmart, and you can go to forrespect.org, that's F-O-R, forrespect.org. There'll be a link on my website. In fact, there's a bunch of links to the Walmart stuff as it is at Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. My guest is Liza Featherstone. She's a labor journalist, and she's been covering Walmart for more than a decade. Why Walmart particularly? I mean, is this your, I mean, you've made this your area?
I think that one of the reasons that Walmart has interested me for so long is in part because of the widespread effect that that company's actions seem to have on others, and also it's a fascinating company culture in terms of the compliance and engagement that it has over the employees that a lot of people really when I've interviewed people they feel very invested in the company and usually that investment and that profound feeling that employees have for Walmart. Usually that takes the form of just being very loyal to the company, keeping their head down. But every now and then it manifests itself in people really being very angry and taking ownership and wanting to change it. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, I think it's really fascinating, and it's one of the reasons I continue to write about this company.
Well, you know, there was just this fire in Bangladesh where over 100 garment workers were killed in it, and we were talking about the 19th century. We can go into the 20th century, and the famous, some people probably know about it, a shirtwaist fire.
That's right. I thought of that too.
And then we find out that this Bangladeshi company was making clothing and garments for?
for Walmart, although we should clarify that Walmart is saying that it wasn't making garments for Walmart at the time of the fire. And I think we'll see over the next few weeks as folks do more reporting on that, whether or not that was true. So we should, just qualify that to be fair.
And in terms of how, what the United States, American companies have done in terms of exporting jobs, they really exported, the 19th century. So the conditions in Mexico and China and Bangladesh and Ceylon, places like that, are what workers suffered in the United States, probably in the 1840s, not even by the 1880s. And what's the effect? I mean, there's always this downward pressure on wages, essentially this threat effect against workers in the U.S. because of what's paid there, right?
That's right. I mean, and because they can have things made so cheaply overseas, they really, as you say, exporting this 19th century factory model of horribly unsafe conditions, very long hours, very very low wages, and it makes it easy to say to workers, if you're at one of the few factories left in Alabama or Tennessee, places like that, your boss is probably saying to you constantly, you guys better go along with this, because we can always ship your job to Mexico, or we can always ship it to China.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a very, I think some studies have shown that outsourcing is in some situations more powerful as a, more effective as a threat than it even is as a reality. That is, you know, even when they're not actually going to export those particular jobs, you know, or those particular factories, you know, because sometimes the company finds it more efficient to do production here still.
Sure.
You know, it's still a very powerful effect and has a very powerful threat and kind of...
what's called capitalist, I call it capitalist blackmail. But Liza Featherston, we only have a few minutes left. Let's turn back to where we started. We were talking about Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. We were talking about Walmart, and we're talking about the organization, Organization United for Respect at Walmart, which is at forrespect.org. And the company says, oh, you know, next to none of the workers walked out. Percentage-wise, and virtually none of the customers respected the boycott, and so they say it was a total flop.
You know, the boycott, there was not really a very serious call for a boycott. I don't think that part was I actually am not even sure there was a boycott, and if so, it was very thinly publicized. The more serious action was that workers did walk out and that several hundred of them around the country did, which is not a large percentage of Walmart's something like 1.3 million U.S. workers. But it's a lot more than have ever walked out before. So I'd say, you know, it was the Black Friday was yes, certainly a win for the company in the sense that it enjoyed huge Black Friday sales, but also a win for the beginning of a workers' movement at Walmart.
Yeah, I think beginning is the operative word. Yes. Walmart's slogan is save money, live better. One of the things that people, I think, fear is that that if we had, for instance, a living minimum wage, so like $12 an hour as the baseline for wages in this country, that Walmart would simply raise their prices to people. And although Walmart workers, the 1.3 million or 1.4 million of them would get substantially more income, that that it would wind up costing the average Walmart shopper more money to enter the premises.
Well, a couple things to say on that. First of all, I think Robert Pollin, an economist at UMass Amherst, has done a lot of studies of the relationship between price and workers' pay, for instance, in the garment industry, and showing that there's usually quite a bit of room to raise wages and without passing it on to the customer by more than a few pennies. And, you know, so often the relationship between prices and wages is not as, you know, it's not as simple as we think. They're making a lot of profits in and there are a lot of other efficiencies in the system. However, I would also say that even if it did result, even if they did pass the cost along to the consumer, by raising Walmart workers' wages, you would have an effect on the rest of the labor market, and many of you would see your wages go up as well because your employers would not be in a race to the bottom with Walmart.
Yeah, and how
so
does like
you might not need those low prices as much.
There you go. And Costco, of course, has unionized workers, and they're competitive. And also the Walmart heirs, the Walton family, is worth about $100 billion.
Exactly.
And what do they have more wealth than something like almost the bottom half? So I think we could do that. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. And there is so much more to talk about, but fortunately we have some resources. One would be the website For Respect, For, F-O-R, respect.org, and that is the Walmart workers that are trying to drag Walmart into at least the 20th century.
That's right.
At least the 20th century. And my guest has been Liza Featherston. She's a labor journalist, and she wrote Walmart Workers Walk Out, The Nation. What week was that, or what date? Do you remember?
You know, it was actually a few weeks ago. That article was about the previous walkout, which was in October.
Okay.
So, as you see, this is not just a one-time thing.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being my guest on the show. And this is something, you know, people don't always know when history is confronting them. I don't know that the GM sit-down workers in 1937 knew that they were going to be part of American history, so you never can tell. Liza Featherstone, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks so much, Peter.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit. Everything that rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com. Rockin' Detroit at 101.1 FM and the rest of the planet online at WRIF.com.
Listening for your next chance to win. Details online at WRIF.com.
I've been stuffed in your pocket for the last 100 days. When I don't get my bath, I take it out on the slaves. So grease up your baby for them rockets now and swallow those pills and say,